Good morning, Council. Are you ready to proceed today? Okay, now we have a multiple parties, so my understanding is the parties have been able to reach agreement on how the time will be divided. It's my understanding, Mr. Lau, the State of Hawaii as petitioner will have 23 minutes. Respondent Hawaiian Homes Commission will have 14 minutes and then be followed by respondents Richard Nelson et al. With 23 minutes. If you have any time remaining at the end of your 23 minutes that you reserve for rebuttal, you'll be allowed to have rebuttal at that point. Is that everyone's understanding?
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. Thank you very much.
And each of you, just for your information, there'll be a yellow light will go on when there's 5 minutes remaining in your time and then a red light when your time is expired.
So, thank you, Your Honor.
If you'd please proceed, Mr. Lau.
Gerard Lau, representing the State of Hawaii and its Director of Finance, we'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal time. Good morning, Your Honors. Plaintiffs in this suit are making the most extraordinary request of the judiciary. They are asking this court, they are asking the judicial court to usurp the legislature's traditional prerogative of appropriating money to state departments and order the legislature to appropriate a particular amount of money to the Department of Hawaiian Homelands based upon their personal opinion of what is an appropriate amount, rather than based upon anything written into Hawaii's constitution or laws. Plaintiff's demand, therefore, amounts to an unprecedented affront to separation of powers. Plaintiffs make this request based upon a constitutional provision, Article 12, Section 1, its sufficient sums provision that provides absolutely no judicially manageable standards for coming up with any particular funding amount. The sufficient sums provision of Article 12, Section 1 is thus judicially unenforceable because of the political question doctrine. There are simply no judicially discoverable standards for evaluating whether the legislature has appropriated sufficient sums for homesteads without resorting to initial policy determinations of a kind clearly for non-judicial discretion. And this is quite clear because Article 12, Section 1, because nothing in Article 12, Section 1 or the Hawaiian Homes Commission Act gives any guidance as to how many homesteads must be developed in any particular period of time. And if we don't know how many homesteads must be developed in a particular period of time, there is simply no way to determine how much funding needs to be appropriated to develop that indeterminate number of homesteads. Now, knowing how many people are on the wait list does not resolve the problem either. For if there are 24,000 people on the wait list who want a homestead, does that mean the legislature must provide each and every one of them a homestead within 1 year, 10 years, 50 years? There's simply no way to know from the sufficient sums provision, which says nothing about how fast the homesteads must be provided to those on the wait list.
If I may interrupt you, Mr. Lau.
Yes.
I have concerns about the ramifications of this decision one way or the other, and I have a question for you that I'd like to ask to the other councils as well. But assuming that we would go your way, would the political question doctrine give the state a free pass in perpetuity in spite of the language of sufficient funds, which is in Article 12, Section 1?
I don't think it would be a free pass at all. What the provision does is essentially provide a moral force, it implies a duty on the part of the legislature to do something, that the framers were not happy with the pace of homestead development. And they were basically trying to urge the legislature to do more. But because the framers of this provision did not provide any guidance as to how many homesteads have to be developed in a given period of time, they provided the legislature with no guidance so that they can determine how much money has to be provided. If you don't know how many homesteads have to be provided, then there's simply no way to determine how much funding is necessary to provide that indeterminate number of homesteads. So I don't think it's a free pass, but what it does make, the application of the political question doctrine would render the provision judicially unenforceable, but that's the necessary consequence any time the political question doctrine is applied. Whenever the political question doctrine is applied, the provision becomes judicially unenforceable. Now, plaintiffs would like to suggest that that renders the provision essentially meaningless, but I don't think so. Again, it tells legislators that the framers thought that more funding should be given. And so what it does is it gives a duty, a sense of duty on the legislative body to give more. It also provides them with a reason for telling their constituents who might object to more funding in these especially difficult economic times. It gives them a reason to say, look, the reason we're going to provide more this time is because the Constitution, you know, is telling us they want more for this particular program. And so it does not become meaningless in any way. And
Mr.
again,
Lau,
yes.
You talked at I'm sorry, Justice W.
No, I just was going to make a comment that it's been 33 years, so it's been a pass for 33 years since the constitutional amendment was voted upon and passed and approved by the voters.
Yes, and I think it would be incorrect to think that somehow the state has been remiss in its duties here. What plaintiffs like to point out is they say, well, in this last year they've only given $800,000 in general funds, and what they forget and what they neglect to point out is that in fact the state has been giving, in the last biennium they gave over $14 million in general obligation bond financing for the Department of Hawaiian Homelands. The Department of Hawaiian Homelands also gets substantial funding from other sources. In fact, the federal government, for example, has given over, let me get the numbers for you.
Is what the federal government gives relevant to the Hawaii Constitution, which says that our legislature shall give sufficient funds?
Absolutely, because in order to determine what the legislature needs to do to provide sufficient funds, you have to look at what the total source of funds that are available to the department. If the department has a lot of sources of funds from other sources, then that's clearly relevant to how much the legislature needs to give, because all of this money from any source is available for developing homesteads. And so it would be wrong, as plaintiffs seem to suggest, that you somehow ignore all the other sources of funds when all those monies are useful to developing homesteads.
I think you mentioned $160 million. Was that in 1 year that was...
That was for a biennium, and in fact, when you look at what the legislature has actually done in the last 2 years, the actual numbers are...
160 included monies from the federal government and other kinds of...
Correct. That's correct, Your Honor. In fact,
when we are to construe the term sufficient funds, would those funds from other sources be a set-off against the requirement that the state provide sufficient funds?
I think as I was responding to Justice McKenna's question, yes. It's set off in the sense that you have to look at all the sources of funds that are available to Department of Hawaiian Homelands. I think it would be absurd to say, well, let's ignore all the money that the Department of Hawaiian Homelands gets from federal funds, from special funds, from trust funds, when all that money is available to develop homesteads.
And if our goal... Does $60 million include anything for the Native Hawaiian Reparations Act?
If you're referring to
Article... Or the past breaches? Or
yes, that does include that.
But isn't that supposed to be excluded?
According to the legislature, when they provided that, they said, let's exclude that. But we're here to interpret Article 12, Section 1, which is a constitutional provision. And so the legislature has no right to tell this court how to interpret a constitutional provision. So even if the legislature says, well, we think this should be excluded when you're looking at Article 12, Section 1's obligation, they have no right to do that. It's for this court, under Marbury versus Madison and the state equivalent, it's for this court to decide what should be considered in deciding how much funding must be provided by the legislature. And there's simply no reason to exclude those funds, those potentially $160 million, when those monies are clearly available to develop homesteads. But let's assume that we put all those trust monies aside. Let's put all the special fund money aside. You still have the state providing in general obligation bond financing for the last biennium, $14 million for capital improvement projects. You have the federal government still providing $30 million. So you have a total of at least almost nearly $50 million.
Mr. Lau, is it correct the plaintiffs indicate that, however, the department had to fund its operations completely out of lease revenues? Is that correct? In the year 2009, I believe.
Well, the department is actually funding its operations from all sources of funds, including the substantial amounts of money from the federal government, as well as the general obligation bond funding.
They're funding their operations out of general obligation bonds? Is that your position?
Well, I mean, I think money is ultimately fungible, because how do you say that one particular source is paying for one particular thing? Ultimately, the department has a pot of money, and it ultimately uses it for all of its purpose, administrative.
So you can take general obligation bond money and use that for operating expenses and overhead?
Maybe not operating, but it's specifically applied to the construction funds or for developing, you know, infrastructure in the project.
Were there in that time period, I guess it was the 2009 fiscal year, any general funds appropriated to the department to cover its operating budget, overhead, salaries, the building, electricity, and the like, or was that number zeroed out in the year?
I believe that number was zeroed out. But again, I think it's wrong for the plaintiffs to then ignore everything else and say, well, legislature's not doing its job here, when in fact they're providing $14 million in general obligation bond financing, which ultimately gets paid back by the taxpayers through general funds. And
why
so
operating and administrative funds, one of the fact that the DHHL had to lease general leases were covering those expenses, and that this department was the only one not receiving general funds for operating and administrative expenses. Wasn't that one of the main concerns raised for the 1978 constitutional amendment?
Well, I think the concern was that basically the concern was they thought that the legislature should be providing more funds to help make this program work, put more people on faster. I think that was their overall goal. I mean, nothing in the provision itself indicates that there was any suggestion of a ban on general leasing. In fact, the Hawaiian Homes Commission Act specifically authorizes the department to general lease. In fact, the general plan that the ICA majority relied so heavily on specifically notes that general leasing will provide for administrative and operating expenses. So it's a sort of an irony that the ICA was so reliant on the general plan.
Isn't it an accurate statement to say that the committee reports, the Committee on the Whole report, the Hawaiian Affairs Committee report, and the floor debate with Chair DeSoto, who was the chair of the Hawaiian Affairs Committee, stating on several occasions that it seemed incongruous for the $1.3 to $1.6 million operations budget of this department to have to come from lease revenues when every other state department was generally funded. Wasn't that not a very clear theme as reflected both in the committee reports and the floor debate? Granted, there were others who identified broader uses of the funds or other uses of the funds, but was that not one very specific issue that was identified in the committee reports as well as the floor debate?
It was, but again, if this court were to then say, okay, state, you got to pay for these administrative and operating expenses, then the legislature could then simply reduce, because of the budget situation, it could then say, well, we've given you more here than we normally would have given, so then we're going to reduce your capital improvement budget. And so it really doesn't help plaintiffs in any way, shape, or form.
It's different from a political question. The question is whether there's a political question which makes this, the political question doctrine would make this non-judiciable, as opposed to the question of whether it would be effective or not.
Right. And I think I guess the ultimate problem with the administrative ordering the DHE or the legislature to provide money for administrative and operating expenses, it runs into the same problem, because the administrative and operating expenses of a department are going to vary depending on how many lots are developed in a given period of time. If you develop bigger projects, you're going to have greater administrative and operating expenses. And because there's no way to determine how many lots have to be developed in a given period of time, there's no way to correspondingly determine how much the administrative and operating expenses would need to be.
Well, why wouldn't the 1978 amounts at least be a floor? I mean, the legislature clearly was dissatisfied, the CONCON was clearly dissatisfied with the state of affairs at that time. They identified the fact that this $1.3 or to $1.6 million was coming from lease revenues. Why wouldn't at least that number be an identifiable, judicially determinable, easily sort of derived number?
I think the reason is because, that plan and that situation was, and the framers at that time were working under the situation that existed then. They were looking at the economic and fiscal situation at that time, thinking that, well, maybe more can be done. But because that's 30 years ago, and because times change, not only do the needs of those on the waiting list change, not only do the conditions of the land that have to be developed change, but the economic and fiscal situation of the state changes. And so I think it would be absurd to look at a plan that was developed over 30 years ago as a guideline for today when we have totally different situations. Even the concurrence in the ICA admitted, the concurring opinion by Judge Nakamura tried to suggest that the 78 situation should set some kind of minimum floor, that you look to what kind of programs, how fast people were getting homesteads at that time. But even Judge Nakamura conceded that you cannot ignore the economic situation, that the fiscal and economic situation of the state does factor into the sufficient sums issue. And when you do that, that admission, which is a correct admission, by the way, automatically brings us right back to the political question doctrine, because then the question becomes, how much does the current budget crisis situation demand that we then adjust the, quote, baseline, the 1978 baseline? Do we?
Mr. Law, just to cap off the discussion before that. So, I mean, the reference to administrator expenses in the history doesn't seem as precise as what we're trying to establish. So if we talk about administrative expenses, we're talking simply about staff, equipment, overhead, that kind of thing. You would have no problem in looking at that as outside of the political question issue?
No, it's always been our position that that too is within the political question doctrine, because as I just noted, because we don't know how many lots are developed, we don't know how big the projects have to be, because administrative and operating expenses will necessarily vary depending on how big a production scheme you have and how fast you're developing lots. Because we don't know how many lots you have to develop, we don't know the administrative and operating.
The primary controversy is about the cost of obtaining house lots and putting them into operation. We're talking about, I think one figure was $50 million, another figure is $100 million a year. So that's separate, isn't it, from the administrative staffing kind of costs that
it is.
Every department in,
yes.
in the state would incur?
Yes, it is separate, but I guess what I'm pointing out is that the amount of those administrative and operating expenses are going to vary depending on how big the projects are that you're working on. If you're developing 3,000 lots a year, your administrative and operating expenses are also going to go up necessarily as well. And because there's no way to determine how many lots have to be developed every year, there's no way to figure out what the necessary administrative and operating expenses are either.
You don't want to follow the general plan as ICA set out. That's your position.
That's correct.
But the ICA said that the Department of Hawaiian Homes and I suppose the commission have to follow the general plan guidelines and objectives.
Right, but the question
so
is
that remains in effect because no application for certiorari was taken from that holding by the ICA.
Well, again, that would be with regard to what the Department of Hawaiian Homelands, which is not our client in this case.
I mean, I'm just asking.
Right,
so
in terms of what?
The Hawaiian Homelands and Commission have to follow the general plan under the final ruling of the ICA.
I don't think the ICA was that specific. It looked to the general plan as some sort of guidance, and what I'm here to argue is that there's no basis for using the general plan.
No, as far as the state's
correct.
Obligation to make
correct.
Payments. But as far as what the department has to do and the commission has to do, my impression was the ICA said they have to follow the general plan, and neither the department or the commission file application for certiorari from the ICA's ruling, so they're bound by that ruling, are they not?
I would suggest because that what they would be bound by could then in turn affect what we might be obligated, we the state as, and the legislature would be obligated to provide for them. There's an impact on us as well, and because we took certiorari on this, I would suggest that particular holding, because it could also impact us, is actually not binding on this court, and that our certiorari petition can overturn that ruling as well. And of course, we don't think that the general plan is the operative standard because there was only one or two delegates out of 100 delegates that even mentioned the general plan. The second delegate even mentioned a contrary standard, and there were three or four other delegates that specifically mentioned other standards, and so there's no basis for reading the general plan as the operative plan. But even if we were to assume that the general plan were the operative plan, it runs into the same problem that Judge Nakamura's concurrence does, that if you use the 1975 general plan, that 10-year plan, or you look at what Judge Nakamura looked at, which is the state, the pre-1976 baseline levels, that the problem is that there's no reason to believe that those standards were meant to be applied to a situation 30 years later. When the economic situations change, as Judge Nakamura admitted, you've got to then factor in that factor. But how do you do that? If there's a budget deficit of $1 billion, does that mean we cut DHHL funding below the baseline by $30 million, $50 million, $1 million? There's no way to determine that unless you make the political choice as to, well, should we try to preserve the funding and raise taxes instead or cut other state priorities? Or do we really try to preserve those state priorities by cutting some funding for DHHL? But then how much? Those are going to require this court or any court to make policy choices as to how to figure out what that balance should be. And that's exactly what the political question doctrine prohibits. And so,
Mr. Lau, is there any other constitutional provision that says that the state shall provide sufficient funds to some other department or for some other cause?
There's other constitutional provisions that say the state shall provide for the public safety and the public health and shall provide for the basically protect the public. It doesn't say specifically say shall provide sufficient sums, but let's take that. Let's assume that it had said the state shall provide sufficient sums to protect the public health. I don't think anybody here would seriously think that a plaintiff could then sue the state because they didn't, because in fact thousands of people die on the roads and drown every year or die of health problems, that they could then sue the state for not providing sufficient sums because they didn't do enough when they could have put more police on the streets, put more lifeguards out in the oceans, provided more funding for medical research. I don't think anybody would seriously think that the state could be sued because they didn't provide enough funds to provide better protection for the public health. And the reason is, the question becomes, how much do you have to protect the public health? That's unknown. That same thing exists here. We're told under Article 12, Section 1, that we have to provide money to develop lots, but we're not told how many lots have to be developed.
Mr. And so let's assume that the legislature provides zero, nothing, to DHHL. Are you still saying that the political question doctrine would prohibit this court from finding a breach of the Constitution?
I think it would, and the reason is it's not the state funding is not the only source of monies for Department of Hawaiian Homelands. Department of Hawaiian Homelands over the last biennium got almost $60 million from the federal government alone. But again, we're not even in that situation today, and we're nowhere close to that situation. We never have been. And so I think that's an issue that maybe is ripe for another case, but it's certainly not ripe in this particular context. I'd like to, if there are no more questions, I'd like to reserve some time. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Miyagi.
Mr. Chief Justice, Honorable Justice of the Supreme Court of Hawaii, I think I should start at first to explain why a department of the state stands in opposition, at least with respect to certiorari on this issue with the state of Hawaii. And that is because this court has made it very clear that the Department of Hawaiian Homelands, through its Hawaiian Homes Commission, has fiduciary duties which may be distinct from the state. And for that reason, once the Intermediate Court of Appeals rendered its decision, the issue before my clients was, would it be in the beneficiary's best interest to require the state to provide sufficient funds for the four stated goals in the Constitution? And my clients came up with the answer, yes. Now, we understand that we took the position at the trial level and in the briefing before the Intermediate Court of Appeals that sufficient sums was a political question and that, therefore, it should not be decided. However, that doesn't mean that the lawyers are infallible. We thought we were correct in making that argument and taking that position before the trial court and in front of the ICA. But once the ICA made its decision, we had to evaluate what was in the best interest of our clients. And our clients are the commission, which has to take into account the best interest of the beneficiaries. And for that reason, we believe that it is appropriate for us to stand in opposition to the state's position that the issue of what is sufficient funds is not a political question and can be determined. We submitted a supplemental brief with the court's permission, of course, indicating that while we took that position, we wanted to make it very clear that we did not want the general leasing powers of the Department of Hawaiian Homelands in any way to be impacted by this court's decision on this issue. Now, the plaintiffs, if you will, have argued that that issue has been dismissed and is not before you. However, if you read the briefing, it's very clear that they have taken the position that if the state is required to provide sufficient sums, that there would be an end to general leasing to generate revenue, which is not what the Constitution and the Hawaiian Home Commission's Act says. The Hawaiian Homes Commission Act makes it very clear that you can general lease, and this court in the AHIA case made it very clear that we, meaning my clients, can continue to general lease as long as that land is not necessary to be leased to the beneficiaries. So that is a distinction that the plaintiffs do not make in their briefing.
So I think your position is opposite to that of what was announced at the Constitutional Convention That is that the, I guess, delegates or some of them did not want the Hawaiian Home, Department of Hawaiian Homes to lease homestead lands in order to raise revenue, and instead they wanted the state to provide the monies, and so that you wouldn't lease these lands, but you would use them for homestead purposes.
That is the opinion or the testimony of some of the CONCON delegates. However, I think you should make it very clear, if you read the AHIA decision by this court, which was after the amendments, and which noted that when the 1978 constitutional amendments were made, putting in this requirement for sufficient sums, they also made it very clear that the general leasing power of the department was continued with respect to, well, not respect to, as contained in Section 204 of the Hawaiian Homes Commission Acts, Your Honor. They explicitly stated that, and this court in the AHIA case made it very clear that, you know, the CONCON made it explicitly clear because they modified that particular provision in that CONCON to allow general public to get the lease as long as the lease land was not necessary for homesteading, if you will.
If I might interrupt you, Mr. Miyagi, and I'm fulfilling my promise to ask you and then Mr. Murakami perhaps a question about the ramifications. If we were to rule in favor of the plaintiffs in this case, a position that you are now apparently agreeing with, I would suspect then you, that the plaintiffs and you folks would be going to the legislature to ask for the sufficient sums, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
And then what happens if you folks don't agree? Do you come back to the courthouse and ask the lower court, first of all, to set a number and then have the case percolate up to us?
The ramifications are perhaps the heart of why we initially thought this was a political question, Your Honor. However, I think you can get guidance, if you will, from perhaps a very isolated sentence in the majority opinion by the ICA. And the printed portion that I have is page 14, which discusses the policy. And Judge Foley, writing for the majority opinion, says, in making its request for funds, DHHL shall be guided by the policy and standards set forth in the 1978 Constitutional Convention and DHHL's April 1976 General Plan and any revision thereof. Whether DHHL's request for funds from the legislature is reasonable is reviewable by the court, and then they cite to AHUNA as the authority for that. So this is the first time that I have seen in any of the opinions that the use of the word reasonable to guide the demand or the request or the definition of sufficient sums is to be used. And I would suggest that that is a very logical term to apply to determining what is a sufficient sum. And, for example, we all understand the current economic climate, nationally as well as locally. We understand that there are many needs that our state has. So if the amount is challenged by the plaintiffs or any other group as not being sufficient, the court would have the ability to look at the total circumstances of our economic climate here and determine whether or not what has been requested is reasonable. And that would also incorporate, for example, the state's concerns or argument, if you will, earlier, that you should take into account all of the other sources of funding for DHHL.
But if you follow that argument to its logical conclusion, then the court system would be reviewing annually what are sufficient sums. That doesn't seem like to be judicial fair to me.
I would hope not, but that is a worst-case scenario, if you accept this argument, Justice Duffy. However, I would think that as long as, and perhaps my understanding of the law is not as precise as it should be, that this court and all the other courts, in reviewing the requests of the departments, gives some deference to what they believe is reasonable. Doesn't mean that you will automatically substitute your personal judgment, as long as what is been suggested and requested is reasonable, so the sufficient sum is deemed reasonable.
But the difference is not so much to the Hawaiian Homes Department, but the deference to the legislature, right? Isn't that what we would be involved with? I mean, would that put us at loggerheads with the legislature? In order to determine what's reasonable, are we limited or focused only on what would be reasonable for the objectives of the department, or do we have to, as Judge Nakamura suggests, take into consideration the whole economic picture? And if we do that, would we be posing our judgment against the judgment of the legislature?
I would anticipate that Creative Plaintiffs Council would say that in a complaint that they'd file in the circuit court. However, I don't believe that that is an insurmountable barrier, because what is reasonable under the entire circumstances would have to be determined. And yes, there would be deference, if you will, given in some sense to the legislature. But if you read the opinion, it also seems to require that the department make the request. And the department's request, if you will, is to somehow be evaluated separately from what the legislature actually does. Because obviously, you know, the department can ask for anything it wants, but the legislature is not bound by that. We understand that. But the Constitution says what the Constitution says, and I am forced to take this somewhat awkward position of being in opposition to the state. But I just wanted to make sure that the court, in ruling on this specific issue, did not take away the department's power to general lease, which was made express in the 1978 amendments to the Constitution, as well as affirmed by this court in the AHIA case. If there are any other
questions. Mr. Miyagi, what's your client's understanding of the current status of count two, which was alleged a breach of trust obligations on the part of your client to seek sufficient funds from the legislature?
That was dismissed without prejudice.
Count two?
I believe so.
No.
No, it was not.
So it was and do you understand that that was left intact or vacated by the ICA? And if so, where does your client stand on count two at this point?
I don't think it was vacated by the ICA. My understanding, if I understand what the ICA said, it had a very specific statement under section Roman numeral 3, which says the issue on appeal is whether the legislature has provided sufficient sums to DHHL pursuant to Article 12, Section 1 of the Hawaii Constitution, a political question. That is the only issue that I believe is the heart of the entire opinion. They go and discuss how they get to their answer that it is not a political question, but that was the only issue that they decided. And they decided that it was not a political question. So to answer you, I don't think the ruling has had an impact on count two.
So it would still be summary judgment would still be effective for your client on count two? Is that your client's perspective?
I believe so, yes.
Didn't the ICA actually vacate the entire judgment of the circuit court?
Let me read the conclusion.
Section 7 of its opinion. And actually vacating the judgment that probably dismissed counts 3 and 4 that you stipulated.
That's right. It says, therefore, the final judgment is vacated, and the court is remanded to the circuit court for further proceedings. So, yes, the summary judgment was vacated. Are there any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Murakami.
Your Honor, may it please the court. My name is Alan Murakami. I represent the appellants in this case, who are beneficiaries of the Hawaiian Homes Commission Act. The political question doctrine does not apply. Moreover, I think this court is in a position to go further and declare that at some base threshold level, the level of funding that the state has provided this department under this provision is clearly, plainly, and admittedly insufficient. And that's what we're seeking as a base matter.
Judgment?
I'm sorry?
Did you move for summary judgment in the trial court?
We did not, but we were relying on Flint versus McKenzie, a case which recognizes that if a summary judgment motion is brought by a move-ont, the non-move-ont, that's us, could ask for relief at the time of the review of that judgment. And so we're asking for that basic ruling in order to set the record, at least a threshold straight, as to where the state has been in upholding its duty under this article. And we think that under these circumstances, it is justified.
Mr. Murakami, do you think the state is obligated to provide funding separate and apart from the other funding, the federal funding, the bond funding that...
Absolutely. For one thing, I think it's a matter of conjecture whether any of those other sources are sufficient or adequate enough for what the department needs to do, which is one of the most fundamental things that this state has promised to do under the compact with the United States to administer this program faithfully. The provisions for the sufficient sums came some 19 years later to implement that that spirit of the law, but I think there's no measure under which you can judge any of those so-called other sources of funding to be adequate anyway. So we're engaged in some matter of conjecture as to whether or not, you know, those other sources can take care of this provision when it clearly has not.
If there's no measure to determine whether or not the other funding is sufficient, how is the trial court to determine what sufficient sums are?
Well, I'm speaking of what has happened historically. But under the law, Justice Nakayama, I think it's very clear, and based on the ICA decision, that there are clear, judicially manageable and discoverable standards. And the ICA decision lays them out.
What is the relief you're actually requesting? The state seems to be suggesting that you are requesting the court to order that sufficient sums be funded. It was my understanding, reviewing your complaint, that you're requesting a declaratory ruling that sufficient sums are not being provided.
Yes, Your Honor. We're on record asking for declaratory relief only, not for damages and not for actual determination of a specific number. But we are addressing, and frankly, this is probably one step in a multi-step process. We are at the base level saying to this court, please help us. 33 years ago, the CONCON established the standards, the thresholds for how to judge whether or not this particular provision is being met. But we're asking under the complaint for a simple declaration that under the clear and undisputed facts that are before you today, actually, that court and this court can declare that the amount of funding provided by the state has been clearly, plainly, and admittedly insufficient. And that's where we start.
First amended complaint in count one says plaintiffs are already also entitled to a mandatory injunction requiring the state to provide sufficient funds. So would that injunction not direct a particular amount of money be paid?
Your Honor, you can see that that's a very general statement. And in our effort to be artful in our pleadings to include all potential relief we'll be seeking, we included that. But there's no specification of any amount or anything like that. But this is an attempt to get the full range, a panoply of remedies that we hopefully will have to rely on in the future should this court reach this question on the merits. And there may be some kind of injunction required. For example, our count two asks that the department be held in violation of its trust duty to seek funding. They haven't been seeking the sufficient sums, is our claim. Perhaps an injunction may be appropriate in that instance should that claim be resolved in our favor. We don't know that yet, but we're at step one. We're here asking to clear the hurdle. Let us enter the courthouse door. Declare. Yes.
Would you be satisfied with a declaration that the state has not provided sufficient funds?
That's a key part of our declaration.
Would that be the end of it? Would you be satisfied with a declaration to that effect?
I could not say that, Your Honor, because what we are basing our claims on are not standards that we have made up. These are standards that are clearly evident in
the... I'm not talking about the measure of whether or not the state has failed to provide sufficient funds, but you're asking for the appointment of a special master to monitor payment by the state, which would require the court to oversee payment by the state of sufficient funds. And I suppose to enforce that order, i.e. hold certain people in contempt if sufficient funds were not paid.
Well, Your Honor, it's hard to foresee what might happen in the future, but you're correct.
I'm just talking about what normally happens if you fail to obey an injunctive, mandatory injunction by the court.
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. I think that's correct. It may be initially shocking to think about what it could mean, but, you know, again, these are constitutionally derived standards. We're not making them up. We are asking this court, by striking down the political question doctrine, to give meaning to this provision.
If the court issued a declaratory judgment, just a declaratory judgment, would that impact the political question bar, or would it?
Well, we're asking for two separate things. Okay, the first step is declare the political question doctrine inapplicable, because it really doesn't apply in this instance. No decision that you've rendered when faced with the question of interpreting or enforcing a constitutional provision, no court has shied away from addressing the merits of that claim. The political question doctrine has been set aside, because I think this court, much as the other courts that we've cited in our briefs, there's 19 of them in the question of adequate funding of educational systems, 19 states have taken in that debate your side to address, whenever possible, on the merits, the applicability of a constitutional provision. And we're urging this court to not break that string in your record, because this is an important and very profound issue. It is at the very foundation of our Constitution and our existence as a state. And so we ask you to follow that tradition and set aside the political question doctrine as the first step, and then reach the merits on the declaration.
Insufficient funding. You posit that having someone wait on the wait list for a homestead for 10 years clearly shows there's been insufficient funding. Michael Connie said, it's 5 years should be the measure. So the state says, where do you get the 10 years? The 10 years is no place in the record. So what is the measure of insufficient funding?
Okay, seems like everybody ate some crow today. So what I'm going to say is that we made that up, but we did not make up the statement in the 5 year in the strategic plan passed in 2003, adopted by the commission, that says that the waiting time should be 5 years. So hey, we're happy to shorten that time if the commission itself is willing to say that as a matter of a strategic plan, an applicant should not wait longer than 5 years. That's in the record. That's what they adopted. It's not our standard. We gave an outside period of time. But clearly, Justice Akoba, for a person to wait, as more than 1,700 people have, for more than 30 years for a homestead is completely unacceptable. And this court should say so. By making this declaration, there's a threshold that we cannot go below.
Is it your argument you can state that proposition without having to necessarily precisely define what sufficient funding is?
I think so, Your Honor, because the situation is so dire, the funding levels are so low, zero is never sufficient. And unless the burden is on the state to demonstrate that some other sources of funding overcome and offset all of that, they have not been able to do so. General Leasing, to 100%, to the extent of the administrative and operating budget, revenues for that budget, is a demonstration of insufficient sums.
Should the trial court be able to take into consideration, as Mr. Miyagi suggests, the economic climate in determining what is sufficient, what are sufficient sums?
Your Honor, there, of course, is concern about that. I hear that from Justice Duffy. We don't want it to be so crass as to say we don't care about the total economy. Everybody cares. What we are careful to urge this court to be guided by, however, is what the constitutional principles are, have been, that have been enunciated by other courts. Two of them, in Alabama and in Washington, have said this about that particular issue, and it's in our brief on page 14. It is a fundamental principle of constitutional law that constitutional obligations cannot be avoided because of lack of funding. That's Alabama. Washington said, "We do not doubt that ever-increasing demands upon the legislature by state agencies, departments, and institutions have reached near-crisis proportion. However, none has the mandatory constitutional recognition found in Constitutional Article 9, Sections 1 and 2. That's dealing with the adequacy of the state education budget. Though the crisis is recognized, it does not change the constitutional duty of the court or the legislature." So that's kind of like our bottom line. We have this proposition. It's in the Constitution. It's the supreme law of the land. It says what it says. And I join Mr. Miyagi. The Constitution says what the Constitution says. Perhaps there are economic consequences. We don't know what they are, but that's in the future. We are here today to set aside the political question doctrine. We may need to revisit that occasion at a later date. I can't predict that. And I think it would be unfair to simply dispense with this particular claim simply on the potential for some ramification on the economy.
What is it that you say that you may want to revisit in the future? Whether the trial court can take into consideration economic climate?
Well, I think I did say is that it may be some question in the future when this concern arises, but it is at this point purely speculative. And yes, we may have to be concerned about that, but I think we fundamentally and primarily have to be concerned with what the Constitution says.
Aren't you asking us to send it back to the trial court?
Yes, we are.
Determination?
Yes.
So isn't it rather imminent, if you get what you want, for the trial court to for what the trial court should have to take into consideration in determining what a sufficient sum is?
Well, clearly, what we raised before the trial court has one of the most profound implications on the future of this homesteading program. The Constitution does say that the state is obliged to provide those sufficient sums. What that means in dollars and cents, what that means in terms of ramifications of the total economy, to anticipate what Justice Duffy might have in his mind, frankly, is speculative at this point. But because the situation has been so bad, I think it is a necessary confrontation of this issue. We have brought this as a matter of last resort because of the years of neglect.
Mr. Murakami, just so we're clear,
yes.
Did I understand you to say that the judicially determinable standard would be whatever the operative general or strategic plan, current operative strategic plan of the department is, and you refer to the 2003 plan, which indicated a goal of having everyone off the waiting list in 5 years. Is that the position of the plaintiffs in this case?
It's one of the positions, because the general plan is just one of the standards. The concern for the pace of development was the first one. The ability to release the department of the burden of general leasing was another. The general plan was the third. And finally, the question revolved around whether or not the state should have any discretion in funding this particular budget. The Constitutional Convention is very clear. They stated specifically that they would no longer allow the legislature discretion in this area, because the situation was so bad back then, when 5,200 people were on the wait list. Today, there are 23,000 people and more and growing on the wait list.
Just real quick, which plan would govern in the plaintiff's view, the 76 general plan or the 03 strategic plan that you mentioned? What would be, ultimately, what would the court, would you anticipate the trial court would be asked to, or a funding level submitted to the trial court based on which of those documents?
Well, what I think the ICA had in mind, and what I think is the appropriate standard, is that, of course, these general plans are subject to revision and may be amended. And that's what the ICA contemplated, and that is probably the appropriate standard. There have been subsequent general plans and strategic plans to which I've referred that are not in the record. But these are the standards by which one of the set of standards by which the judge, the court should be, should follow in assessing whether there is sufficiency of funding. And it is appropriate to view these standards on the basis of any subsequent revision, we believe. But at this point, yes.
The standard would change when the plan is revised?
Well, Your Honor, I guess that's necessarily so if there is a revision.
So every 5 years we would be determining whether or not the plan was appropriate to meet sufficient sums of spending.
Well, Your Honor, that's presuming.
You know, if you have plans
yes.
that are revised every year, they provide standards. That's
yes.
fine.
Yes.
But our test is judicially, was it ascertainable and manageable standards. So that's why I think the majority tried to pick one standard, the general plan.
Yes.
Judge Nakamura tried to pick one standard, a floor,
pre-1978.
So, I mean, we have to land someplace
that's right.
on a standard that we can apply into the future. But if you're saying, you know, every time a plan is revised and that becomes a standard, that doesn't seem to be, that's fine. That's a standard for everyone else. But I'm not sure whether it's a standard the judiciary can apply.
I understand what you're saying. And perhaps the judiciary at one point can look at this, those standards as the ICA did and say, this is the floor. This is a specific, judicially discoverable, and manageable standard, and you can apply that. And we continue to believe that it can be. And we believe that because the situation is so dire and the funding has been so low that you can apply that standard even if it's in the past, because it showed under the general plan what at least the view of the commission was at that time to achieve the objectives that it had set out for itself. Some of which, by the way, Your Honor, crosses over to this issue about general leasing, because if you read those goals and objectives, one of them includes the standard to try to minimize the amount of land that would be subject to general leasing by finding sources of revenue, primarily the state, to meet the requirements of the department's duty to provide homesteads. And so I think you're right that sets the floor, and it is something specific, discoverable, and manageable, and we agree with that. I cannot deny, however, that the commission may from time to time change the standards and the plans.
Well, Mr. Murakami, would you agree that based on the convention's history, the committee reports, the floor discussion, including Chair DeSoto's discussion, that certainly one minimum would be that the administrative costs of the department as they existed in 1978, which were identified as something like 1.3 to 1.6 million, should be generally funded. Would you agree that that was at least a clear, consistent theme at the Constitutional Convention?
Yes, Justice Birkin, and I thank you for reminding me of the fourth standard that slipped my mind earlier. The level of the administrative operating budget is, in fact, one of the manageable and discoverable standards that ICA identified, and it should be. And $1.3 million, Your Honor, back then, I don't know what it means today, but there was no finding necessarily that that was sufficient for the department's administrative operating expenses. Today, if you look at the budget documents that were filed in the motion for reconsideration, that figure is currently up to about $13 or $14 million. And all of which is coming from the general lease revenues of this department. So not only has the level of the general lease revenues soared, but the exclusive reliance on general lease revenues has gone to 100% as it was back 33 years ago. We are trying to set the motion forward in this case. We do not want to go back as the state is proposing. These protestations about how they cannot figure out standards, how they can't figure out what's sufficient, is completely unacceptable, and this court should say so. This is not a homesteading and trust program that was imposed yesterday. It was imposed 52 years ago, five decades, and these are the questions that you're hearing today. It's not only disturbing to us, but it's starting to sound tragic, because this is one of the most fundamental programs that this state has ever accepted as a responsibility to administer. And this case calls out to the conscience of this state. We ask this court to answer it, not hang up on that call. And it is a clarion call that is asking for a simple thing. It's calling out for simple and plain justice. Declare that the political question doctrine cannot apply because this court wants to hear this case. And declare that that the level of funding, as demonstrated historically so far, has been clearly, plainly, and admittedly in the budget documents submitted and the motion for reconsideration, insufficient, contrary to Article 12, Section 1.
Thank you very much, Mr. Murakami. Mr. Lau, how much time does Mr. Lau have remaining? 2.5 minutes, Mr. Lau, for your...
Thank you, Your Honor. I think Justice Duffy and Justice Nakayama, Justice Koba, have pointed out the main flaw in their position. If this court rules in favor of the plaintiffs, this court and every court will be called on every year to start reviewing the funding amounts that the legislature provides. How is a trial court, or this court for that matter, going to decide every year when the economic situation is a certain way, that therefore we can allow DHHL to receive a little more or a little less? The trial court's going to have to be making these fundamental fiscal decisions, like should we instead say, well, let's not cut their budget, we can actually raise taxes, or we can cut other state priorities. How is a trial court going to be able to do that? It's going to have to do that by injecting political policy decisions of its own.
Mr. Lau, be that as it may, how can the state survive a mandate that it provides sufficient sums and allow this people to stay on the waiting list and not receive Hawaiian homes for all the years that it's been in existence? Is it a meaningless mandate?
It's not a meaningless mandate. And again, I think it's...
Make it meaningless if you're not required to provide funds?
I think whenever the political question doctrine is applied, it renders the provision judicially unenforceable. And so it cannot be that the doctrine cannot apply simply because it renders the provision unenforceable and perhaps less meaningful than it might otherwise have been had the political question doctrine not been applied. But that's always going to be the case, and that cannot be a reason to not apply this. The problem here is even if you have a mandate for the legislature to do something, because the mandate was not defined in any way that a court can come up with an answer to that question, even though you make it mandatory, it's mandated to do what? And the problem is the what is not defined here, how fast people must be put on the waiting list. And it's important to remember that not everyone on the waiting list is necessarily in need of rehabilitation. The Hawaiian Homes Commission Act was designed to rehabilitate Native Hawaiians. Some of the members on the waiting list maybe have jobs, may have homes, and may be in a condition where they don't need a homestead to be rehabilitated. Conversely, there are many on the waiting list that are financially strapped that they would not, even if they were offered a homestead, they would not have the financial means to be able to build and construct the house on that property. And so it's very misleading for the plaintiffs to suggest that everybody here is going to be waiting a long time when they are actually needing rehabilitation and can actually afford to actually develop a homestead and put a home on it. I think we need to get out of our minds the notion that somehow the legislature is being beyond the pale and not giving enough money here, when in fact they ignore the fact that the state has been giving $14 million in general obligation bond financing, as well as the federal government giving $50 million. I think the general plan itself says that administrative and operating expenses are to be covered by general leasing. And again, as I pointed out earlier, the administrative and operating expenses do vary depending on how many lots have to be developed. And since we don't know how many lots have to be developed, we can't really determine administrative and operating expenses as well. Plaintiff's remedy is with the legislature, and that's where this lies. It should not be with the courts of law that are not supposed to be making policy decisions that basically direct the fiscal policy of the state of Hawaii. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Lau, thank you to all counsel this morning. The court will take this matter under advisement.
I'm good.
I'll have to ask you a question. Hi. Was it the IC?
It was Dallas Santos.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's just that I was in there.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, that was him once. That was last year? Yeah. It might have been the year before. It feels like it's been a while. Yeah.
It's Keith. I mean, that's how I'm there.
Which do they use? 5 minutes.
5 minutes.
5 minutes. Okay,
thanks. So I'll put the yellow light on when you've gone for 25 minutes, okay. And then red light is all 20 minutes.
I'm going to say Mr.
Case number SCWC-29792, State v. Keese. Arguing for the petitioner, Kersha Durante. Arguing for the respondent, Stephen Tsushima. Argument on the merits.
Good morning, counsel. Are you ready to proceed? All right. It's my understanding, Mr. Durante, you've reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. Is that correct? And you'll get a warning light when that you're beginning to get to that 5 minutes of time during your argument. And then, Mr. Tsushima, you'll get a warning with 5 minutes to go in your argument. All right. Very well. Please proceed then. Thank you.
May it please the court, Deputy Public Defender Kersha Durant on behalf of petitioner Mr. Jason Keese. With the court's permission, as previously indicated, I am requesting that I be allowed to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May.
Your Honors, on January 29, 2009, Mr. Keese had the right to use physical force to discipline his son. And the force that he employed was done in due regard of Julian's age and his size. He limited the amount of force that was used. He limited the number of spanks that were used. And the spanks were focused on an area of Julian's body that was covered with clothing, his buttocks. And his actions are protected under the law. In this case, the Intermediate Court of Appeal gravely erred in several ways. First, the ICA erred in holding that there was sufficient evidence to sustain a conviction in this case. Second, the Intermediate Court of Appeals erred in holding that the prosecutor did not engage in prosecutorial misconduct. Third, the Intermediate Court of Appeals gravely erred in making presumptions about evidence that was received during the trial in order to sustain the conviction. And lastly, the Intermediate Court of Appeals gravely erred in failing to address Mr. Keith's request to stay the sentencing pending appeal. Focusing first on the ICA's error in finding that there was sufficient evidence to sustain the conviction. First, there was insufficient evidence to establish that Mr. Keith had the requisite intent to harass, annoy, or alarm Julian in this case. The complainant, Julian, testified that his father hit him because he was misbehaving. That was clear from his understanding. Mr. Keith testified that he spanked Julian because he had verbally disciplined him previously, and that was on January 27, 2009. He had verbally disciplined him already, and then the behavior had escalated. And he had also warned Julian at that time on January 27th that if the behavior did continue, he would be getting spankings from his father. So it was clear to Julian that the reason why he was spanked on January 28th, 2009 was because he was disciplining him for the escalation in behavior. Additionally, Mr. Keyes himself testified at the trial that his intent when he did spank Julian was to discipline him. So the only evidence that was elicited in this trial supports a finding that his intent was to discipline Julian. His intent was not to harass, not to annoy, and not to alarm Julian. And therefore, the Intermediate Court of Appeals gravely erred in failing to find that there was insufficient evidence to establish the requisite state of mind for harassment. But additionally, and probably more importantly, the Intermediate Court of Appeals gravely erred in failing to find that Mr. Keyes's conduct was justified under the parental discipline defense statute. The elements for parental discipline, for an individual to assert the parental discipline defense and which the state must disprove in a trial, are that first, the individual is a parent or guardian, and I think that was undisputed in the trial. Additionally, that the force is used against a minor for whom the defendant has to care for. And in this case, again, this is the biological father of Julian. It's undisputed that this is a minor that he cared for. Julian lived with him at the home with Julian's mother. Third, that the force used must be done with due regard to the minor's age and size. This was clearly the area of contention in the trial, and I will address that momentarily. But lastly, that the final prong for the parental discipline defense is that the force must be reasonably related to safeguarding, promoting the minor's welfare, including the prevention of misconduct or punishment. And in this case, again, the fourth prong, it's clear from the record or the evidence in trial that that was also not disputed. The state conceded that the force used was done for the purposes of disciplining Julian. So the issue at the trial was very narrowly focused on whether the force was used with due regard to the minor's age and size. And there is something very significant that I want to point out from the Intermediate Court of Appeals memorandum opinion, which is that they did look at the size of Mr. Keyes. That was referenced in the memorandum opinion. And I think they noted him as being, they gave his height and his weight. But that we're asking that the court strike that from the record. First, that was not included in the evidence, or that was not elicited in the trial. In this case, I did review the transcript. There was no questioning as to my client's height or his size. That information was obtained from documents that were inappropriately attached in the record on appeal, and therefore that cannot be evidence that the ICA should have considered in rendering their opinion, but also that is not evidence that is before this court in deciding the case at this point.
Putting aside that, counsel, though, didn't the trial court have the opportunity to observe the defendant and the child in person?
That is correct, Your Honor, and I think that's reflected in the court's findings of fact and conclusions of law. But even with the court giving consideration to the size of an individual and their child, I think it would lead to absurd results if there was a finding or a holding that a parent that is larger than a child is not able to discipline. This case, the facts of this particular case, which involved an 8-year-old child, approximately 4 feet tall, and although there was no actual evidence elicited about his specific weight, he was observed by the court to be of thin build. This case is similar to State versus Robertson, where the Intermediate Court of Appeals found that it was an appropriate use of parental discipline when the defendant in that case used a belt to spank his son 10 to 15 times, 8 times, which made contact. That was spankings to a bare bottom, and though that spanking resulted in bruising, which lasted for several days. Now, granted, the minor in that case was older than the minor in this case. However, the height of that minor was 4 feet, and this is the minor in Robertson. The weight of that minor was 50 pounds. So in that sense, there's a factual similarity between this instance case and that of Robertson. And Robertson was an Intermediate Court of Appeals case. I understand that, but it has not been overturned.
Not to interrupt you, counsel, but isn't the child in this case 6 rather than 8, as you mentioned?
Yes,
and then in the defendant's weight was 140 pounds, so it wasn't like it was an overwhelming difference. I mean, say a 300-pound adult. So I don't. Are you saying that was a significant factor in the conviction?
I'm sorry, a significant factor. I'm sorry.
Are you saying that the disparity in the size of the minor child, age 6, and the 140-pound defendant was a significant factor in the conviction?
I think when the court reviews the findings of facts in this case, that it does appear that one of the factors that Judge Liu considered was the small size of the minor, and that because of the small size of the minor, 6 years old, and being of thin build, that he did determine that the force, that Judge Liu did determine that the force used was not employed with due regard to his age and size. And so my position is just that if that is the case, all parents are larger than their children. So just looking at the size, the comparative size of a parent to a child, the analysis should not stop there. It needs to go beyond that. And I thank the court for correcting me. It was in Robertson where the minor child was 8 years old, and in this case, 6 years old. But the size of the individuals, because that is a factor under the parental discipline defense, the size of the minor, I think, is a consideration that this court and that the trial courts need to apply in determining when parental discipline is appropriate or when that defense is appropriately raised. But in this particular case, the trial court and the ICA both erred in finding that simply because the minor may have been 6 years old or simply because the minor was only 4 feet tall and of a thin build, that therefore the parental discipline defense was not appropriately used.
Didn't the ICA also consider the means of the discipline, the use of a stick with, I guess, sufficient force to leave welts that were noticeable the next day?
Yes, Your Honor. That was a consideration as well. Again, I think it's clear from State versus Matavale that the use of any type of instrument to discipline a child is not something that's going to automatically preclude the use of parental discipline. And in this case, it was referred to as a stick, but the force was used and directed in the buttocks area. And I think that was also an incorrect limitation that the trial court and the ICA put on the facts in this case, that to simply stop the analysis because an instrument was used to discipline is also inappropriate. That is a factor, but I think, well, when the court views the other evidence in this case, which indicated that the injuries were red marks to his arms, and that was because the minor was trying to prevent the punishment from happening, and a red mark to his face, that type of injury is also much less severe than that of Robertson, than that of many other cases in the litany of parental discipline cases that have come before this court and the ICA.
And in addition, in State versus Montevale, the language is clear that even where there's an isolated instance of bruising, that that is not something that precludes the use, that is not something that renders the parental discipline, the use of force for parental discipline inappropriate.
Although Montevale was a much older child, correct? 14.
That is correct. That is correct.
Is that a legitimate consideration? I guess looking at the age of the child in relation to the nature of the discipline being imposed.
I think that is obviously something that the court must consider, and that's clear from the language of State versus Montevale, because it's a case-by-case basis for the court to make a determination. But in this case, and the type of force that was used, that this was not an incident where there was excessive force use. This was a slap to the face, which Mr. Keese testified was done because the minor had lied about getting into trouble again that day. The slap to the face, Mr. Keese testified that it was not hard because he is much smaller than him, and that's his son that he loves.
And yet it was visible the next day.
The mark to the face, there was testimony that there was a mark observed on Julian's face.
Wasn't there a photo of that also?
I believe there was a photo that was admitted into evidence. But the marks, again, in many other cases that have come before this court and the ICA, there have been visible marks left on the minors up to 8 days, 6 days. In Robertson, the minor, it was only after 8 days when he went to the doctor.
Robertson was a memorandum opinion, was it not?
Yes, it was. It was a memorandum opinion, but it was never overruled by this court. And under HRAP 35, I think it can be cited and used as guidance for the trial courts, and it has been used as guidance in arguing before the trial courts in parental discipline type cases. So at this point, that is something that when I review the parental discipline history or the case law that has come already, a lot of the minors are older, and in that sense, it's factually dissimilar. But Robertson is a case where the minor is relatively close in age, relatively close in size, and that is, at this point, good case law as far as whether or not the parental discipline defense is appropriate in those types of situations.
Not for precedential value, though. Let's make it clear. It's usually when you say good case law, that's for precedential value, and specifically memorandum opinions are not allowed to be cited for precedential value.
And I guess with HRAP Rule 35, if I can clarify, that it is used and cited under HRAP 35 as persuasive value to the court. And to that extent, I guess in my experience before the trial court, that case law has been considered, when offered for its persuasive value, has been deemed persuasive. But aside from that, in the case-by-case analysis, which is required under Montevale and the parental discipline statute, the analysis of the facts in this case indicate that the force was not excessive, that the force was reasonable. It was clearly related to parental discipline. While there were red marks, this was not a case where there was bruising for an extended period of time. This is not a case where the minor was unable to carry on with his daily activities. He went to school the next day. And that's also significant as well. I think the fact that the parents in this case, or Mr. Keese in this case, disciplined the minor, and then the minor was sent to school, also indicates or suggests that the force used was not done with an intent to be excessive. It was done with the intent of disciplining the minor to help with shaping the minor, his character, and who he was going to be in the future. And there was also a graduation. This was not a case where Mr. Keese automatically used force, physical force, to discipline. On the first day when it was brought to his attention that Julian had been misbehaving, he talked to Julian. That was on January 27th. They sat down. They talked. He took away the Xbox. He took away other privileges that Julian was entitled to. That did not work. And because that did not work, and because Julian's behavior escalated the next day, escalated to the point that it was not only the teacher reporting that he had engaged in misconduct, but it was a cafeteria manager who felt that Julian's conduct had risen to the level where it was important enough to bring it to the teacher's attention and ask the teacher to notify the parents because he was spitting and wrestling with children in the cafeteria.
I guess if the child misbehaved 3 days in a row and lied to his father, then I would think a reasonable person would not come to the conclusion that some discipline was necessary for the welfare of the child. So in this case, well, who decides whether the discipline was with due regard to the age and the size of the child?
If I understand the question correctly, Your Honor, I think it's the parent's ultimate duty to determine or
who legally decides
sorry.
Whether discipline was appropriate.
Then it would be the court in applying the parental discipline, I guess the trier of fact, applying the facts and the relevant law. But given
anything in this record that would skew the ultimate decision of the court that the discipline was inappropriate for the age and size of the minor?
There was no medical evidence in this case to indicate that the injuries suffered were so severe as to preclude the use of the parental discipline defense. And I think, well, when looking at the intent with the amendment of the parental discipline defense and also the case law that has come since then, that it's clear that even though the use of force to discipline children may not be something socially acceptable, that is something that under the allowable statutes and the boundaries of the law as it stands.
Sorry. In speaking in terms of burdens and duties and, allocation of who decides what, is there anything in this record which would indicate that the court's ultimate decision was skewed for some reason?
Well, I think that the court failed to find that the state did not disprove parental discipline was appropriate in this case. The court in this case, it appeared to say that it just focused on this one factor, and that was the factor of the force that was employed, and that it was not done with due regard to his age and size. But the consideration of those factors and whether or not it's raised by the defense, it's still the state's duty to disprove that. And I think that the fact that there was significant evidence, it was undisputed this was for parental discipline, that even though there may have been some type of indication that it may have been excessive under the standard of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, that the state failed to disprove it beyond a reasonable doubt that this was parental discipline. So that is another way that the trial court erred in this case.
Did the defendant indicate in his testimony that or acknowledge that had he simply spanked the child with his hand, that would have been sufficient as opposed to using a stick? Was there testimony to that effect, and what would you make of that testimony?
I think, if I recall from my review of the transcript, that was in response to a question from the prosecutor, so it was on cross-examination, and his statement was that he had spanked before. I think it's not clear because they do have two children. Spanked before, and that has been effective in the past. But that statement in and of itself does not preclude the use of the force or the type of force that was used in this particular case, because for various reasons. First, he did, as I indicated, it was a graduated or as an escalation of misbehavior in this case. He misbehaved, talking was used, non-physical form of disciplines were used, and that was not effective. And it was at that point that physical force was used. And a physical spanking, while it was speculation, first of all, for him to acknowledge that it may have been effective. But regardless, the parental discipline defense protects the decisions of a parent to discipline a minor in the way that they deem is appropriate for that particular situation. And in this particular situation, because of the graduation in misbehavior, because of the fact that not only did the behavior escalate, but the minor lied on the date of this particular incident, it was reasonable for him to use force other than just with his hand. And again, it's really significant in this case that the focus of where the force was, the focus was directed at his buttocks. This is not a case like other parental discipline cases that have come before this court. This is not a case where the parent was trying to hit the minor in the face, where there might be a risk of some type of serious injury. This is not a case where there was any type of excessive force used. This was a case where a parent used essentially a stick to spank their child on the bottom for a limited amount of times, 5 to 6 times, this is not like Robertson, where the father instructed the son to pull down his pants to expose his bare buttocks to be spanked with the belt. He was exercising due regard for his age and size by focusing the force in an area that would make the point, but would not be excessive. And unfortunately, the minor did try to prevent that, and then there were marks on his arms. But again, under Matavale, the fact that there are marks or bruising, again, would not preclude or would not render parental discipline inappropriate in this case. And that still is a hurdle that the state would have to overcome in disproving that parental discipline was appropriate.
So you're arguing that it should be up to the parent to decide what form of physical discipline to use?
That is a yes, Your Honor.
So this was a futon stick, 18 to 24 inches long is what the trial judge found. This is a stick used, you know, to hang the futon and beat the futon. Would beating the way a person would beat a futon, would that be reasonable?
Well, had that evidence been elicited in this case, that would be something that the court could consider.
Isn't it for the fact finder to determine what level of force was used?
And that is one of the reasons why, in this case, the trial court erred. Because the trial court just simply said because he was small,
couldn't the
thin
fact
build.
Finder rely on circumstantial evidence and all of the evidence, as well as the welts that were left to try to determine what level of force was used?
Well, there was no evidence that, aside from the marks, which, as observed in the photos, there were red marks. Aside from that, there was no other evidence, I think, where the court could draw any inferences about the use of force used. The prosecutor failed to elicit that type of information.
As in Stalker, couldn't the trial court have considered the defendant's admission, his own testimony, that he started off with a slap to the face, which actually left a mark the next day? Wouldn't that be the totality of the evidence that might suggest the level of force that was actually used with the stick?
Yes, it is ultimately the fact finder's duty to make a finding about the level of force used. But the manner in which, I'm assuming the court is alluding to the fact that there was a smack prior to the use of a stick, and that could show his level of intent or his state of mind, his emotional state at that point. With State versus Matavale, that's also addressed in that case, that even when parents discipline out of frustration or anger, that in real life situations, it is likely that a parent would be frustrated or angry at the time of discipline, but that does not preclude the use of parental discipline as so long as the force is tempered. And there is insufficient evidence in the trial record to establish the level of force that was used. All that's really left in the trial record is that Mr. Keyes admitted that he used a stick. As far as the force used, the only evidence, based on my review, was when the defense counsel asked about the slap and did Julian stumble back after slap? That did not happen. That was really the only question about the use of force used. Now, to draw an inference about the injuries and the injuries giving an indication of the amount of force used, first of all, the injuries in this case were red marks. There's no indication that the red marks lasted for several days. Again, he went to school the next day, so it was not so significant that it inhibited his ability to do his daily functions. But also, when looking at his intent and where he was trying to focus the force, there may have been red marks on his arms, but had the spankings landed in the area where it was intended, had they not been blocked by the minor, that would have landed on his buttocks. So there may have been red marks on his arm, indicating some type of force. But I think, again, it's not just looking at where the injuries happened, but also his intent and the totality of the circumstances, that in this case, even though there were red marks, his intent was to spank his buttocks, where it would have been fully clothed, where any type of injury would have been muted, I guess, by the presence of clothing. But I do see that my initial time is up, Your Honors. We are asking that the court reverse the conviction in this case because there's insufficient evidence to sustain the conviction.
Thank you very much. Mr.
Tsushima, your argument.
May it please the court, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Stephen Tsushima on behalf of the State of Hawaii. As noted by opposing counsel, defendant appellant presents four questions to this court. I'd like to start with what I believe may be the question of the day, the sufficiency of the evidence question. And starting with the sufficiency of the evidence with regard to the harassment offense itself, it appears both parties agree that Stalker provides guidance in this case, but disagree with regard to its application and the reasonable inferences which may be drawn for the evidence adduced in the case. Both parties agree that the state of mind of an individual may be read from his or her acts, conduct, and inferences fairly drawn from all circumstances based on Stalker. Both parties further agree that in Stalker, this court found that the family court in that case could reasonably have inferred that defendant slapping his son in the face intended his conduct to annoy or alarm his son. Now, defendant here argues that based upon the reasonable inferences drawn, his only intent was to punish Julian for lying and for his misbehavior in the cafeteria. Defendant further argues that the ICA's analysis that defendant hit Julian with a stick and his open hand does not lead to any inference that he hit Julian with the requisite mens rea. Defendant argues in his application for cert that although he was mad and disappointed that Julian had lied and misbehaved, unlike the situation in Stalker, there is no evidence that Keese was angry, yelling, or struck out with intent to harass, annoy, or alarm. However, like the defendant's doctor, defendant acknowledges he got mad at Julian. Defendant's argument appears to rely on a distinction between being mad and being angry and yelling, to which the state finds none. In this case, there, with regard to the harassment offense, there's multiple intents shown. While defendant characterizes his intent as discipline, there's also the intent to annoy or alarm, which can accompany such intent. I'd like to turn to the parental justification defense, which this court has discussed in detail with co-counsel. And I think we're both in agreement on the standards.
Mr. Tsushima.
Yes.
I guess what troubles me in this case is marginal fairness of this trial. And I don't know, did you read through the transcript?
Yes.
The prosecution continually asks the complainant, do you remember telling me that you said this? No. You see anything improper about that?
Yes.
What is that?
Well, amongst other things, one of the things is what defendant did argue in their brief, and it's bringing a hearsay out as a court statement, but it's also making the attorney part of the, I guess, as a testifier by wording the question in that manner. And I think we did.
In this sense, the lawyer is reading into the record evidence, and it's not subject to cross-examination. Mm-hmm. Yet it's done over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. And the court sustains or overrules objection to that question over and over and over again. Do you think the defendant in this case got a fair trial?
Yes, I do.
Why, in light of that?
If this would have been in front of a jury, I think I'd be hard-pressed to say he got a fair trial, because at that point, you have a bunch of jurors who don't know what to do with this evidence. But in this case, there's a presumption that the court's going to disregard this incompetent evidence.
It's a helpful presumption to judges and to appellate courts. But my question is, I assume that presumption's rebuttable, right?
Oh, yes, yes.
So wouldn't that presumption be rebuttable if the court, by its rulings, indicates that it has an erroneous view of what the law is, by continuing to overrule objections to what clearly are improper questions?
No, I don't think that would rebut the presumption.
You don't think in that situation we can say the presumption should not apply?
I think in that case, the court was just moving the matter along. I think he saw that the prosecutor was going to continue to ask this question.
The court didn't understand the law, you're saying?
No, I think the court did understand the law. I think the
Why
court.
Why did it overrule the objection?
Just to move matters along. He saw that the prosecutor was going to ask this question. He was going to get this answer. He was going to ask it multiple ways.
Actually, sustaining the objection would shorten the trial. I'm so sorry. Go ahead. Well,
go ahead. I'm sorry.
Assuming this is prosecutorial misconduct, yeah. How is it harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
It's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt because we are dealing in a bench trial where the court can disregard the questions that were being asked or any incompetent evidence. And the record supports that because the court makes no reference to any of the evidence that was seemingly being brought in or attempted to be brought in. So we totally admit that these questions were error, but it's not reversible error under the circumstances. Again, I do concede.
The prosecutor also says that, well, this isn't hearsay. It's to bring out a consistent statement. Is that
right? Prior inconsistent.
Is that correct under the rules of evidence? That the reason for eliciting these answers are that it's a consistent statement?
I don't think under these circumstances it would have been particularly.
Do you agree that's incorrect?
Correct.
That use of. The rule of evidence concerning consistent statements.
Correct.
So that would be another thing to add to whether or not this was a trial that was tried on the law and on correctly tried on the law and on the evidence.
Whether it would be a factor to be considered, whether a defendant got a fair trial?
Yes.
Yeah, sure. Now, what it seems here is that the parties do agree on the standards, and that's whether, and in this case where we're looking at the parental justification, the defense, we're looking at whether the state has elicited sufficient evidence to prove beyond a reasonable doubt.
If I could come back to that, is there anything in the record to indicate that the court put substantive weight on any of these prior statements?
Is there anything in the record to show that it did put substantive? Yes. No. The record seems to show that the court did, in fact, disregard it. The court made no reference to any of these statements that are being complained of or the questions relating to those.
Were any of the objections related to the fact that the prosecutor might have been improperly testifying about matters that occurred outside the courtroom?
I'm sorry, what was the...
Were there any objections along the lines of what are being asked here today, that it was improper for the prosecutor to talk about conversations he had with the witness outside the courtroom? Was that the basis of any of the objections as opposed to hearsay or some other basis?
No, I don't think they used prosecutorial misconduct as the basis for the objection. I think it was just improper. It was more of a general, if I remember right. The objection that was used at the trial level.
Were on other bases?
Were on other bases and was not on for prosecutorial misconduct.
Of course, we would have to assume that since the court overruled the objection, it allowed whatever the prosecutor said into the record and into the evidence and allowed the answers, the responses of the witness, which would have been stricken, you would think, with respect to those questions.
To consider substantively? Yes, I don't think so.
Because those questions elicited, well, the witness nodded or shook.
No, I don't think we have evidence that the court considered
substantively. Well, we don't have evidence it didn't, right? Because the objection was overruled, so the matter was allowed.
We do in that the court's specific findings with regard to, and I believe what we're getting at is the question
I don't have the specific findings in front of me, but okay. I did read them, and I recall the court just made statements, mm-hmm. didn't attribute it to any particular witness or any particular testimony. Recall that? They just flat out said whatever it needed to in order to meet the elements.
That's correct. And I believe the question that we're talking about is the question relating to whether or not Julian had remembered if speaking outside the courtroom, he had mentioned that he was hit in the face with a stick. I believe that's the complaint of questioning that we're talking about. And when I say look at the findings of fact, and that's not specifically mentioned there, although you're correct, Justice Acopa, the court didn't mention which specific testimony it got the a specific striking or discipline from. There is no mention of Julian getting hit in the face with a stick, and that's the question.
Because there was no evidence.
Correct.
That he was struck in the
face. And that's what I'm trying to say is evidence that the court disregarded it as incompetent evidence.
Well, I don't know if the court disregarded it, but in his argument, final argument to the court, the prosecutor said, we don't have evidence of that. In effect, said, we don't have evidence of the child being struck in the face with a stick.
In that the court disregarded it, yes. Yeah.
Go ahead. Didn't Officer Cullen testify that when he asked, he met with Julian, and he asked how he got the red marks, and as to red marks, he had been talking about red marks across his arm, his hand, and across his face. Officer Cullen did say that he stated to me that Daddy spanked him with a yellow stick.
Yes, that is in the record. I don't believe that was brought in for the truth of the matter asserted. I don't think it, or was argued that way.
There's no objection to that question.
And there is no objection to that question.
There was a hearsay objection.
Oh, there was a hearsay.
And it was overruled.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Okay, the next day.
Mr. Shishima, in your brief, you concede that the court erred in not staying the sentence. And in so doing, you rely on 804-4. Is that correct?
Correct.
And that's a bail statute, isn't it?
Right.
Was Mr. Keyes sentenced to jail? Wasn't he just sentenced to...
No, he was not. No, okay. It was just parenting classes.
So does the statute then apply if he wasn't sentenced to jail?
That was still my understanding of the statute. I'll admit it's possible I misread the statute, but my understanding, I guess, in not considering whether imprisonment was part of what the defendant has a right in the posting bail statute, but I may have read that statute broadly.
Well, also, doesn't 804 also say that... except as provided in 641-14A, and that allows for the court to have discretion, doesn't it? So how would you read those two statutes in conjunction with one another, even if bail were imposed?
I don't have the statute in front of me. I apologize.
All right.
But I thought that the part where the court had discretion wasn't as to the petty misdemeanor. I could be wrong. I apologize. I don't have the statute in front of me.
Doesn't 804-4B say that no defendant entitled to bail shall be subject to the operation of any sentence passed upon the defendant?
Yeah, that is my understanding, yes. So
would that not have entitled the defendant to a stay of the operation of the sentence of probation?
That's what I thought. That was my understanding of reading the statute. Which is why I believe in that one, on the brief, we did concur. But admittedly, I had not considered what Justice Nakayama had just pointed out.
About 641-14?
Correct. And I apologize that I don't have that statute in front of me. But in any event, in regard to that particular issue, defendant's conviction would not be reversible on the strength of that issue alone. So even if this court does decide to address that issue and find that defendant should have been granted his stay pending appeal, that would not justify a reversal of the conviction in this case. Now, counsel was here and discussing some of the factors that the state had pointed out in its brief, which went to the court's consideration of whether there is due regard in this case to the age and size of Julian in administering the discipline. The state would want to point out that no single factor, of course, precludes the justification defense, but this is just some of the factors that the court should take under consideration, and I believe both parties are in agreement that one of the things the court does have to look at is all the circumstances of the case, and then in this case, that's relevant to a determination of whether the force used in this case was reasonable or moderate. In this case, this would be the first time the court is reviewing a case where the minor is so young. This would be the youngest case at 6-year-old. And there's a mention of him being 4 feet. What we do have is under 4 feet, unknown weight. But without debating at it, the court can look at the photos of Julian under Exhibits 2, 3, and 4, as well as defendant's own description of Julian as pretty small.
Mr. Sushima, are you aware of any other cases, either 6- or 7-year-olds being involved?
Parental discipline cases?
Yes.
As far as opinions, either published or unpublished?
Yes.
I am aware of one other unpublished decision.
What is that?
That would be... Tylo in 2007.
What's the name of the case?
Tylo. I believe it's General Tylo. The last name is spelled T-A-I-L-O. And that was an unpublished ICA 2007 case. And in that,
the holding in that case?
That was an abuse case. It was reversed on another matter, however. In that case, I believe that it was a 6-year-old daughter who hit her school note on that was with regard to misbehavior. The court found that there was sufficient evidence in that case based on the child's age, the child's stature, and the nature it's inflicted, that the court could not say as a matter of law, when viewed in the light most favorable to the state, there's insufficient evidence to disprove defendant's parental justification defense. In that case, the child, the 6-year-old daughter, was hit with a back scratcher many times, so hard it broke. In that case, they had a health aide who testified that that was the worst bruising she had seen in 20 years. There was a bump on the head, bruise on the arm, extensive bruising on the body, left shoulder blade, down the back, and on the buttocks. So admittedly, there were a lot more visibles in that case.
Thank you.
As far as this court, however, this would be the first time the Supreme Court has seen a case of this size, this age. And what we have, again, we all agree the kid was small. We have the finding of fact 16, although challenged, it said, based on the fact finder's own visual observations, Julian was a thin, slight boy and much smaller in comparison to the defendant. What we need to do is we need to look at the age and size, and we need to look at, as well, the misbehavior or the misconduct. And in this case, the misbehavior was described by Ayako as too playful in the cafeteria. I think there's reference to spitting food as well as blaming classmate for making him do these things. In this case, we're not dealing with poor grades. We're not talking about skipping classes. We're not talking about a kid who was punching the parent. We're looking at some playful misbehavior, which defendant has characterized as being dangerous, but there's actual testimony by Yako that it was not dangerous. In this case, with regard to the playful misbehavior that occurred in school, defendant had slapped Julian to the face with such force that you could see a visible on the cheek, which I believe is, forget which exhibit it was in, but one of 2, 3, or 4 shows a close-up of his face. He was struck with a bamboo stick with such force that visible welts were shown, and at least 5 strikes were administered upon Julian. What that evidence shows, and with regard to the court's finding of whether the force was used with due regard for the agent's size of the child, is it shows a reasonable inference of a high degree of pain that was not reasonable or moderate given the misconduct in this case, which again was just playfulness in the cafeteria by a six-year-old. And the finding of fact the facts that I just stated was under finding of fact number 12, which was not challenged by defendant and therefore binding upon this court, and that's taking reasonable inferences from the evidence presented, including the photos. The trial court found that Julian was struck over 5 times by the defendant with a futon stick with enough force to leave very visible welts next morning. And again, this court does have exhibits 2, 3, and 4 before it to see for itself whether those welts were in fact very visible. And again, these findings were not challenged. The other thing the state would like to point out is when we're reviewing this, we're reviewing it in the light most favorable to the state. A couple of times while we're talking about the evidence, we have made mention to defendant's testimony, such testimony as, I wasn't hitting him that hard because he's just a kid, with regard to the slap to the face. Now, I think we agree that it was within the court's realm to not believe defendant and to find that defendant was not credible based on the visible injury to Julian's cheek that was clearly visible in the picture submitted into evidence. Now, admittedly, these injuries do not preclude an explanation or consideration of the reasonableness of the force, but the state would submit that the court did have substantial evidence before it to determine that it was not reasonable or moderate, given the mild misbehavior. What we're supposed to look at is the totality of the circumstances. And in this case, it was within the court's realm to find that it was not moderate or reasonable and not reasonably proportionate to Julian's misbehavior and not reasonably believed necessary to discipline Julian. In this case, we have finding of fact 14, which was not challenged by defendant binding upon this court, and that was that no physical force was used against Julian for the 3 days prior for this misconduct. Finding of fact 15, which was not challenged by defendant, which was prior physical force used by defendant or Ayako was usually limited to the use of bare hands, which resulted in Julian correcting his behavior. In addition, there was testimony by Ayako that she planned on discussing Julian's behavior in the cafeteria together with defendant. Ayako told Julian, when they get home, they'll be talking about this together, so that they would just talk. There's no testimony from any other witness other than defendant that Julian was told that he would be spanked if he misbehaved again. And again, that goes to credibility, and that would be the weight of the evidence for the trial court to determine. The court could have, and was within its right, to disregard that testimony and find that defendant was not believable. The court was in the best position to see the defendant while he testified, look him in the eye and say, no, I don't believe you. So when this court is reviewing the evidence, the state would point out that it is to be reviewed in the light most favorable to the state and that credibility issues were left for the trial court to determine. In addition, the other thing defendant had mentioned is that he himself had admitted that a hand spank on Julian's bottom would have been effective in this case. What that turns to is the state's ultimate conclusion, and that's based on the particular circumstances of this case, it should not be said as a matter of law that when viewed in the light most favorable to the state, there is insufficient evidence to disprove defendant's parental justification defense. Under the circumstances of this case and taking a reasonable inferences from the evidence presented, as well as finding fact 12, which I just stated, which showed that Julian was struck 5 times with a futon stick with enough force to leave very visible welts. Considering the totality of the circumstances, there was substantial evidence from which the trial fact could conclude the force employed by defendant, that is, the degree of force and the utilization of the bamboo stick, was not moderate or reasonable. And if the court doesn't have any further questions, that's all I have.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Hunt, your rebuttal.
Just briefly, Your Honors, the fact that Mr. Kisei testified that spanking with a hand had been effective in the past does not preclude him from exercising his discretion as the parent in this case and determining that a different method of discipline was appropriate and necessary. That still does not
eliminate the need for the court to assess whether or not the method of force he did use in this case was reasonable. And it was reasonable in this case, as articulated earlier. With respect to the testimony or the suggestion that because the misconduct was not dangerous, that it was merely playful, that that meant it was not reasonable, the punishment or the discipline used was not reasonable. First and foremost, he was being disciplined for lying. He was also being disciplined for misbehaving. Whether or not that misbehaving involved being dangerous or playing with others dangerously is irrelevant. His father had told him that he had confronted him about misbehaving. He had told him if he continued to misbehave, he would be punished. He was being punished for disobeying his father. But there is, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Ms. Durant, why does the statute concerning when 804-4 apply in this case?
It applies, Your Honor, because, first of all, by, I believe, this plain reading of the statute, an individual that is convicted of a petty misdemeanor offense is entitled to bail as a matter of right, which along with that includes the stay of any other type of sentence, including probation and parenting classes.
Doesn't the sentence start, no defendant entitled to bail? And was he entitled to bail in this case? He wasn't, was he? He wasn't, didn't receive a imprisonment sentence, did he?
I think the question is that given the fact that the statute indicates that all individuals who are convicted of a petty misdemeanor are entitled to bail as a matter of right, that the indication is in that situation that the court or the legislature deemed it appropriate that individuals convicted of petty misdemeanors should not have to suffer the punishments imposed pending the resolution of an appeal. And
wouldn't they have said that, though? Wouldn't they have said, instead of saying no defendant entitled to bail and putting it in the bail statute, wouldn't they have just said that no defendant convicted of a petty misdemeanor shall be subject to any sentence passed upon the defendant?
Your Honor, I don't have the 804 right in front of me right now, but it's my understanding that that is the indication in that statute. I may be incorrect, and I know that there's also case law that discusses 804 with specifically its application in petty misdemeanor cases, and that is something that we've argued many times before the trial courts.
What about, well, we're here now, and what is the difference, what is the, what is the import of the phrase, except as provided in 641-14A, which allows the court to have discretion.
And Your Honor, I apologize. I don't have HRS 614 before me right now, but I do know that the bail statute also discusses not just convictions for petty misdemeanor, but also felony and other types of offenses. And I'm not sure if that may be referring to the discretion a court can exercise in those circumstances. But I think there's also policy reasons why an individual should be entitled to bail or a stay, I should say, of a sentence pending appeal when the conviction is for a petty misdemeanor offense, because of the fact that just given the natural judicial process that that can take a while. And if there is an appeal, then we're obviously raising an issue that we believe is an appropriate issue that resulted in an incorrect conviction. And that given those circumstances, that public policy would also support staying a sentence which would likely end before the resolution of appeal.
Totally see that insofar as a jailable, an offense for which jail is a sentence. Anger management, family counseling. Do you think public policy should dictate that that sort of counseling should wait until after appeal is over?
Well, two things. One, requiring the defendant. I'm sorry, Your Honor. I see my time is up. May I answer that question?
Or finish your response.
Thank you. Requiring the defendant to undergo anger management while a case is pending an appeal where we believe that there's a legitimate issue, I think, is counter to what our position would be, which is that if we believe that there was an incorrect conviction in that case, then therefore any resulting punishment or counseling even would be inappropriate. But in addition to that, Your Honor, in family court cases, the defendants are usually referred to the Family Peace Center for classes, and the amount, the financial burden to the individuals for paying for those classes is significant. It usually involves 24 weeks of classes, which can is a sliding scale range, but it usually can be up to about $900, even for indigent clients, and they would have to go through that first before undergoing parenting, which is what I believe was ordered in this case. So while I understand that there may be a good basis to require or a reason to require an individual to undergo counseling, I think in light of the fact that this is a petty misdemeanor, in light of what we would be arguing in an appeal, that it would be inappropriate to require it at that time, that public policy still weighs in favor of staying the sentence pending appeal. And for those reasons, we're again renewing our request, asking the court to reverse the conviction.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments this morning. The court will take this matter under advisement.
Case number SCWC 30500, State v. Peck Peck. Arguing for the petitioner, Stuart Fujioka. Arguing for the respondent, Don Fudo. Argument on the merits.
Morning, counsel. You're ready to proceed? Mr. Fujioka, I understand you're reserving 5 minutes for rebuttal, so you'll have a yellow warning light when we get to that 5 minutes. And Mr. Fudo, I understand you'd like a warning 7 minutes to go with your with 7 minutes to go. All right. Very well. If you'd proceed then, Mr. Fujioka. Thank you.
May it please the court, Stuart Fujioka, appearing for petitioner, defendant, appellant Orlando Peck Peck, who is not here. He's in custody. The United States Supreme Court has said that each count in an indictment is regarded as if it were a separate indictment. And that's from Powell, which the ICA had cited for other reasons. But at Orlando Peck Peck's trial, there were groups of restraining order violations which had allegedly occurred on the same day. Orlando was subject to a restraining order prohibiting him from contacting his ex-wife, Andrea DiMauro. Unfortunately, he had left a bunch of voicemails and text messages which Andrea preserved on CD and turned over to the prosecution. And that was very critical evidence at trial. For example, on November 16th of 2009, there were counts 8 through 15 involved 8 voicemails preserved on separate compact discs. They were numbered as exhibits and time-stamped, but the exhibit numbers did not comport to the count numbers. Each exhibit was not specifically linked to a particular count. The alleged offenses did not reference a time element, nor was the jury instructed that it had to unanimously agree on a specific act as to each count. Looking at each of those counts as a snapshot or a case unto itself, there were 3, 5, or 8 culpable acts which could have constituted charged conduct with respect to the particular groups of offenses alleged to have occurred on the same day. For example, counts 7 through 15 were exhibits 15 through 22. And before that, the state had broken things down so that certain counts, they argued, pertained to text messages, and certain of them were voicemails. But they didn't go further and tie each count to each exhibit, which is what the defendant feels should have been done, either that or a specific unanimity instruction. Of all the specific unanimity cases in this jurisdiction, I think that State versus Munden, 121-08-339, is the most instructive. This is the only one that the petitioner could locate anywhere which involved multiple counts and the same number of culpable acts. What happened there was Munden was acquitted of one count of terroristic threatening and convicted of the other. There were 2 counts of terroristic threatening bearing the same date but no time element. There was no specific unanimity instruction, so what happened on appeal was this court found that there was one conviction, one acquittal, and if the jury did not unanimously decide which act resulted in the conviction, then to retry him would have violated his rights against double jeopardy because he could very well have been retried for his acquitted conduct. And I remember this case because I argued it to this court, and embarrassingly, I missed the double jeopardy issue, but this court caught it sua sponte. But anyway, this is what could happen in any case where you have an equal number of acts and counts without either election or specific unanimity. If so much as one of them results in an acquittal, I don't think the defendant can be retried on the others because it's going to implicate the person's double jeopardy rights.
Mr. Fujioka, yes. In this case, the jury convicted on each and every count for which there was an associated exhibit, correct?
That is correct.
So does that make this case distinguishable from Munden in that regard, in that there were convictions on all of the counts for which there was, in fact, an exhibit, and the jury acquitted on counts for which there was not an exhibit? And
factually, yes, but in terms of his constitutional rights to a unanimous verdict, I don't think so, because we still can't be sure that the jury unanimously agreed on which act supports conviction on each count.
The counsel in this case, 27 counts or 25 counts?
25, I believe. He is acquitted of six.
And they were all the same in terms of language. They're exactly the same except for the date. Is that correct?
Yes, and there were many that were the same date.
None of the counts refer to any specific act. Is that correct?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor.
Or any specific exhibit.
Right.
Or any specific time of day.
That's correct.
So we have 25 repetitive counts. The only difference is that the dates on the counts are different.
I believe so.
And for counts 8 through, and you're only concerned with certain counts in your
Yes, idea, because right? There are somewhere there's one count, one date, and one act. So there's not too much I can say about that at this point.
Right. If there was one exhibit that only referred to one date, for example, November 7th, there was one exhibit for that, then there could be no confusion about which act or conduct referred to which count, right?
Yes, I would have to concede that.
But for counts 8 through 15, there were 8 possible acts which would fit counts 8 through 15.
Yes.
And is there any way to know which acts one juror, two jurors, or all jurors agreed to with respect to, for example, count 8?
And, you know, I think that's the problem. There's not a way to do that. We could conjecture and say they went chronologically or
they're all on November 6th.
Yes. Yes, and I just don't think it would have been that problematic for either the state to say to say this exhibit goes to this count, or for the court to say the jury needs to unanimously agree on what act constituted which offense. And without that, we don't know if the verdict was unanimous.
Didn't defense counsel in his closing, in fact, refer to some of the counts in the chronological order in which the calls had been received? There's a discussion regarding counts 2, 3, and 4, talking about messages left at 10:14, 10:24, and 10:26. So doesn't it appear that the understanding was that they were being presented on a chronological basis?
I don't think that rises to the level of an election, and especially I think I don't recall that argument from the transcripts, but based on what's been recited to me, I think those were acquitted counts.
But the understanding is, at least it reflects an understanding that the timing is that the timing was being viewed in a chronological light, and that's how the prosecutor presented the case. Is that right?
Well, if that's the way the defense lawyer was thinking, I didn't try this case, but if that's the way the defense lawyer was thinking, I still don't believe that rises to the level of an election by the prosecutor. And going back to the earlier question, I think it's to distinguish Munden because of its result being the mixed verdict. I think that's a dangerous way to proceed, because then you'd have to wait to see if the jury goes and acquits on one count, or if the jury manifests its confusion by sending some kind of communication. Going back to the source of Garcia, which I think is Echeverry. It's a federal case from the Ninth Circuit, 19 F. Second, 1974. Body of law is concerned with the possibility of jury confusion or the potential confusion. So I really do believe that it needs to be addressed before the jury deliberates and not during or after.
But in this case, in the opening statement by the prosecutor, this prosecutor referred to 25 prohibited contacts and 25 prohibited counts. Is that right? And 25 counts, pardon me.
You mean 25 counts, 25 acts?
Yes.
Yeah, I think so.
And was there any point during the trial at which the prosecutor suggested that one act might support conviction on more than one count? Was there ever anything to indicate that there was a suggestion that an act could support a conviction on multiple counts, one act?
I don't think so. It was always like a one-for-one kind of thing, but, I don't think that sufficed to safeguard the right to a unanimous verdict when multiple culpable acts occurred on the same date and there was no distinction between them in terms of which contact was tied to which count.
Neither in his opening statement or in his closing argument did the prosecutor link any specific exhibit to any specific count. Is that correct?
I don't think so. I think they went as far as saying, for example, November 6th, there were counts 8 through 15, and he said that's exhibits 15 through 22.
So he said, there are exhibits 15 to 22, they relate to counts 8 to what?
To 15.
To 15.
Yeah, whatever.
So he never linked up any of the exhibits with any of the counts.
The prosecutor did not say count 9 is supported by exhibit 15 or exhibit 16.
And each one of these exhibits constituted an act.
Yes, it was either leaving a voicemail or a text message.
And the court never instructed the jury that when they considered these counts, they were to consider one of the acts pertaining to one of the counts?
No.
And the verdict form didn't reflect that either?
I don't believe so.
So a juror you could have 12 jurors and they would all pick, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, two could pick 5, 3 could pick 6, and the rest would split up between 7, 8, and 9, all for count 1, count 8.
Yeah,
count 18 or whatever.
Yeah, I think that's the danger.
So you would never get, you don't know if you would ever get a unanimous 12 people agreeing on one exhibit relating to, say, count 18.
Yes. So
it's a possibility.
Yes, it's a possibility, and it was easy enough to avoid.
In closing argument, the prosecutor did refer to counts 18 to 25 being text messages, correct?
That's correct.
During trial, did the prosecutor ever say counts 18 to 25 relate to the text messages on November 6th and November 7th?
I believe so, and the text messages were identified as exhibits.
Is there anywhere in the trial by the time of the state's case in chief, end of the state's case in chief, did the prosecutor ever identify any count with a specific text or email? That's really my question.
I don't believe so. And with those texts, I think it's the same problem where you got multiple texts on a given date and multiple text exhibits.
The counts themselves don't refer to text messages or voice messages, right?
No, I don't believe so.
So a juror could look at the count and say, I think the voice message relates to the count, whatever.
Yeah, but, the in fairness to the prosecution, they did go as far as saying, okay, 23 to 25 is text messages.
23?
Count 23 to 25 is text messages.
Is that ones with only one exhibit or more? Yeah.
And then, but then they had three different text messages, and we don't know which is which for which count.
Okay.
So they broke it down, but we don't think they broke it down far enough.
And is a jury obligated to follow what prosecutor says in final argument?
Not necessarily, but I think if they had identified a particular contact to a particular count, then that would suffice as an election.
Are you sure? Doesn't Arceo say you have to make an election before or at the close of the prosecution's case? Otherwise, you need a specific unanimity instruction.
Yeah, if it has to be before the close of the case, then I would think it needs to be done.
Can you make an election and final argument? Not that there was one here, but can you make an election and final argument?
There was a time when I believed that, but if...
When was that time?
I know. If I, rethinking Arceo, I guess it needs to be done earlier.
Arceo was a case in which there were multiple acts being explicitly offered in support of one particular count. Is that correct?
Right.
And that's not the case here. There was a one-to-one relationship between the acts and the counts. Isn't that right?
There is a corresponding number of counts and acts, yes.
So in Arceo, one might say it's unfair for the prosecution to play hide the ball about which acts are in play, and that would be a reason to suggest in that situation there needs to be an election by the close of the case in chief.
Was that the
rationale there, or was there some other rationale?
I don't think it's so much the prosecutor hiding the ball. It's making sure that if the defendant is going to be convicted, the jury unanimously agrees on what exactly he did.
Right, but in terms of the timing of the election, in that situation, the defendant was not the motivating thought there that the defendant should know prior to having to put on his or her case what exact acts he or she was defending against? In other words, the question is, from the point of view of what the timing has to be of the election, is a case like this different from the situation in Arceo where the government is expressly relying on multiple acts to support one count, as opposed to a situation here where your theory is, although there's an equal number of acts and counts, there's some uncertainty as to which act relates to which count?
I think because it implicates the right to a unanimous verdict, if the prosecution didn't want to identify the act in the Arceo case, if they didn't do it by the end of the case, then it was incumbent on the court to instruct the jury that their verdict needs to be specifically unanimous. And in this particular case, yes, there were an equal number of acts and counts, but there's still that potential of prejudice or confusion. And for that reason, either the prosecutor should have identified act to count, or the court could have done it by way of jury instruction. So, I don't see that big of a difference in terms of whether it's one count, many acts, or many acts and an equal number of counts. Otherwise, you run into the problem we had with James Munden.
On the state of the record and with the instructions, could a juror use, for example, a voice message exhibit for what the prosecution identified as a count that related to a text message?
If If they don't follow or accept what the prosecutor has said, possibly. I believe so.
Are you conceding that with respect to count 7, October 22nd, 2009, there's only one allegation as to that date, and count 17, November 8th, 2009, there's only one allegation as to that date that there is no unanimity issue with respect to those two counts?
Yeah, I believe that there was an exhibit identified to that each particular count, yes.
And count 16 as well, is that right? There were three counts that were single-day counts, is that correct?
Yes, I believe so.
Actually, with count 16 was apparently a voicemail, allegedly a voicemail on November 7th, but if, following up on Justice Okoba's question, since there were three alleged text messages covered in counts 23 to 25, November 7th also, the jury could have confused the text messages.
If they disregarded what the prosecutor had said in closing, yes, it's possible.
How does this affect the consecutive sentence? Now, the consecutive sentence, the court said, was related to
count 13.
Count 13.
If I'm right, and Peck was entitled to a specific unanimity instruction, we can't be sure that what the court had determined, I think, was Exhibit 17 was count 13. If the jury was supposed to be instructed on specific unanimity and they weren't, and we don't know if for sure if they were unanimous on which act pertain to which count, then it's a big problem because the conviction being stacked onto the concurrent 1 year for the others may not have been supported by a unanimous verdict. And so I think that if the court accepts the petitioner's analysis on the unanimity, the consecutive sentence was clearly erroneous. And at least that part of it should be remanded because it should have been concurrent if the court couldn't pull out one conviction supported by unanimous verdict and stacked it on to the other.
I'm sorry, what exhibit did the court say or was related to the consecutive sentence? Okay.
Yeah.
I don't want to use up your time.
Okay. I could find it, but that really was the points that I wanted to make on behalf of Mr. Peck. So I will conclude my argument at this time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fujioka. Mr. Fudo?
Good morning. I am Don Fudo representing the state. And at the outset, by way of explanation and not excuse, I would want the court to know that this past summer, I took my daughter to Japan for approximately a month. The reason that's of consequence is because I believe the application for the petition for cert was filed on July 29th. By rule, I had 15 days from that date to file any opposition to that writ. That would make it August 13th, which was a Saturday, so it would be due the next Monday on August 15th. However, I was still in Japan. So I want to apologize for not preparing and filing an opposition to this petition, which I certainly would have, for reasons that I hope will make clear here. Moreover, Having listened to defense counsel and certain questions of the court, I believe respectfully there's some confusion with the record as well as the case law. But what I'd first like to understand is that it seems there's been a concession as to counts 7, 16, and 17. Not just here today, but in the petition, he's not challenging counts 7, 16, and 7. The dissenting opinion in the ICA also concedes that counts 7, 16, and 7 were discrete instances with single acts. I may not have heard this correctly, but Justice McKenna, I don't believe there's an overlap with 17. It was a voice message. The voice messages that are implicated in count 7, 16, and 17 are on October 22nd, November 7th, and November 8th. Those are voice messages. At trial, counts 23 through 25, those are text messages that happened on 7.
That count 16 was a voice message.
Excuse me?
When was that election made?
No, there wouldn't be an election. There's one count, and there's one act.
Oh, I'm sorry.
An election.
Was it in the complaint that it was a voice message?
It's in the jury instructions, yes. That's another confusion. The jury instructions did identify the particular nature of the contact as being a text message or a voice message, and they were grouped accordingly then on dates. There was counts 8 through 15, 18 through 22, and 23 through 25. 8 through 15 are November 6th voice messages. 18 through 22 are voice messages for November 7th. 23 through 25 are text messages for November 7th. So I believe out of the box, 7, 16, and 17, they've been conceded and not challenged. So I'm going to assume at my peril they're not really at issue in this argument. Having said that, I believe what should happen in this case is the ICA's decision with respect to the convictions for counts 8 through 15, 18 through 22, and 23 through 25 should be affirmed and or the decision let stand and this court deny this petition as improvidently granted, as you did in Kaomani, which I'll address in a moment. In petitioner's application, he asserts that there's been a violation of Arceo and its progeny. Therefore, I think it's fair and reasonable, in light of what petitioner's counsel also said, that he is aware of Arceo and its progeny. That being said, Rule 3.3 of the Hawaii Rules of Professional Conduct, as I read the rule, would seem to require a petitioner to have brought to this court's attention two previous cases on these facts decided in this jurisdiction, those being the legal authority that is directly adverse to his position. Those two cases are State versus Horsewill. That's at 75 Hawaii 152, 1993. It's a Supreme Court case. And State versus Kaomani. It's a published opinion by the ICA, 97 Hawaii at 140. It's a 2000 case. I believe that counsel's failure to cite those two cases, or it seems to be aware of the two cases, undermines and exposes a weakness in his argument and also a fundamental problem with his application. Because under Hawaii Rules of Evidence Hawaii Revised Statutes 60259B, the application was required to include grave errors of fact or law or obvious inconsistency between the decision of the ICA and previous decisions of this court, federal decisions, or the ICA. Those would dictate the need for further appeal. Now, Horsewill and Kaomani, they're not inconsistent. In those cases, like the facts you had here, and Horsewill is of particular significance because the RCAO court cited to Horsewill for the plain error standard to review the alleged error in the instructions. The facts of Horsewill were basically this. There were two undifferentiated counts.
Excuse me, counsel.
Yes, sir.
You didn't cite Horsewill. Are you saying somebody else should have cited Horsewill?
I'm saying the rule. Yes, I'm saying that.
Well, why didn't you cite it?
And that's why I initially told this court, because I was in Japan.
Oh, you filed an answering brief, didn't you?
I did.
So in the answering brief, why didn't you cite it?
Because Arceo isn't implicated in this case for the reasons...
You cited Arceo.
I cited Arceo to show that it's not implicated. Factually, it's not implicated because you have an equal number of counts to acts. Arceo stated, and I believe this court reaffirmed the holding in Arceo in Stanger in an opinion authored by, I believe, you, Justice Sokoba, to which Justice Duffy concurred, that the either-or rule of Arceo is triggered in situations when the prosecution adduces proof of two or more acts and attempts to seek the submission to the jury that only one count occurred. In Horse...
What was... How do you spell Horsewell? What was the name?
Horsewell is spelled H-O-R-S-W-I-L-L. In Horsewell, there were, like this case, equal acts to equal counts, undifferentiated, no error, plain error review. Years later in Kaomani, citing to Horsewell and Arceo, you had three undifferentiated counts of defendant inserting his penis into the victim's vagina, and in the course, he also touched her breast two times. There were five charges, three for sex assault in the first degree, three for sex assault in the second degree. In the jury instructions, they didn't attempt to hook an act to a count. And the court noted in affirming the convictions, and let me just read it so I don't misstate it. There were precisely three possible separate and distinct acts of sexual penetration for the three sexual assaults in the first degree counts, and precisely two possible separate and distinct acts of sexual contact for the two sexual assault in the third degree counts. Therefore, quote, there was no need to specify in advance of trial or in the jury instructions the separate and distinct acts in question in each assault, sexual assault count. The case is distinguishable from Arceo, in which there were more discrete acts than counts. This goes back to my initial point that the cert was improvidently granted because there's been no showing that the decision of the ICA is inconsistent with its prior decisions or decisions of this court. In fact, it's consistent with Horsewell, a decision of this court, as well as Arceo. So on that basis, I don't think we should be here, and clearly as the law now stands in this jurisdiction, Arceo, on these facts, is just not implicated. That's what I put in my opening brief. Now, seeing what has been argued, and in much...
He said Arceo's implicated.
Excuse me?
He said Arceo's implicated.
I said. Oh, sorry. I'm sorry.
Opposing counsel said Arceo's implicated because Arceo represents the basic proposition that there has to be a unanimous verdict with respect to any specific act committed by the defendant. And that proposition would apply here.
Well, Your Honor, I'm not disagreeing as to the basic requirement for unanimity, but... Assuming I read your pronouncement correctly in Stanger, you were very specific as to when RCO requirement of the either-or selection is triggered. It's not triggered on these facts.
Stanger didn't involve this kind of facts.
Yeah, it involved more counts than there were acts.
Yeah.
So you have made clear that RCO is limited to that situation. This court has made clear that RCO is limited to that situation in Horsewell, and the ICA understood as much in Kaomani that this situation where there's equal acts to specific counts, it's not implicated.
We never said anything about Arceo being limited. We just use Arceo as a basic precedent. We never say Arceo was limited.
Okay. If you didn't say it was limited, what you definitely did say in a situation like this factually, that there is no error. I mean, that's what Horsewell says, Your Honor. That's what Kale Money says.
Horsewell. You never cited it, so I'm sorry.
And
I'm not familiar with Horsewell, but familiar with Arceo.
Excuse me?
I'm familiar with Arceo.
Okay, and then also in Mundon, I believe that was Justice Moon's opinion to which I believe yourself and Justice Duffy occurred. That dealt with the federal standard that contemplates a genuine possibility that the conviction may have resulted from different jurors finding defendant committed different acts because, as defense counsel said, There were two undifferentiated acts of terroristic threatening in the first degree, and the jury came back with guilty on just one. Under those circumstances, where you don't have the one-to-one correspondence, this court said that, yes, then there was a genuine possibility that the jurors could have convicted on different counts. It's not been in a case such as this, where the facts are equal counts to equal acts, that there's any reason in any part of this record to suggest the juror would have sat there and thought, like the minority in ICA in this case said, that juror 2 would believe Exhibit 15 doesn't constitute proof for anything. However, he would use a different exhibit to constitute the conduct element for two different counts. That's just irrational. Jurors wouldn't work like that when they have an equal number of counts, separately differentiated by date and type of contact for them to rely on to an equal number of counts. You would never get unanimity in that situation. It's just an irrational, the hypothetical is just irrational. They couldn't come to unanimous verdicts in that situation.
Is Mondan's similar in the sense that the jury was never informed which act coincided with which count of kidnapping?
Yes, sir. And so is Horsewell, and so is Khomeini. And when they don't come back with the one-to-one correspondence on guilty, Mondone says...
In this case, the same situation applies, where the jury is not told which act coincides with which count.
What is it... When you say it applies, to what are you referring?
Not told which act coincides with which count.
Correct. The jury was not told that.
And that was the situation, too, in Mondon?
And yes, sir.
And so we said... There was, in that case, then jury confusion, and so we had this. Well, I guess we dismissed because he couldn't be tried again.
Actually, it was a little bit more sophisticated than that. The analysis. The analysis went along the lines of the federal case in Echeverry, and they said they explored whether there was a genuine possibility that different jurors could have found defendant guilty of different acts, and because there wasn't the one-to-one guilty correspondence, there wouldn't be a way to say it. You don't have that here. What you have here...
Here you don't have the connection, like in Mondon, between the act and the count.
There was no connection in Mondon, Your Honor.
Right, and there's no connection here.
The connection here is there's five acts...
Two counts of kidnapping, two acts.
In Mondon,
you don't
two...
know which act. The jury was never told which act related to which count.
Correct.
We have numerous counts and numerous acts. And the jury is not told which one coincides with which count, which acts coincide with which count.
Is that a... I don't understand the question.
Why is Mondon different?
Mondon is different because they didn't convict on all counts. They didn't convict on both.
Why does that matter?
Because under Horsewell and Khomeini, it says there would be unanimous. To have five undifferentiated counts... supported by five exhibits, if they found him unanimously guilty on all five counts, it means they found he committed all five acts. That's what Khomeini says. That's what Horsewell says. That's what the federal courts say. And that's what distinguished Mondon, because they said, well, when there's the same amount of acts to counts and they don't find him guilty on both, then there is a genuine possibility that situation to which you're concerned with, Justice Acoba, could occur. But here... The precedent in this jurisdiction has addressed both situations, when there's concurrence and when there's not. When there's concurrence, like in this case and in Horsewell and Khomeini, there is no plain error. When there's not, as it was the case, like you pointed out, Mondo, then there's a reversal. But the fact that I did not cite Horsewell and Khomeini in the brief, the rule of professional conduct puts the obligation and burden on the opposing party who's against whom those cases work. If he wants this court in a cert situation to...
You're relying on these cases and... Well, I don't want to belabor the point.
Okay.
You're relying on these cases, but you never cited them or discussed them in your brief.
Okay, Your Honor. Correct. So I'll ask the court to take judicial notice of the two cases being in existence in this jurisdiction and being controlling in this particular situation, at least to the extent that both are published and neither have been overruled. I was not the one that brought the case in its posture to this court. Counsel said he's relying on Arceo and its progeny. As of this morning on Westlaw, there's 404 citations to Arceo. Of those, 264 are cases, and of those, if a person is honestly familiar with the progeny of Arceo, you would see very prominently Horsewell and Kaomani. So it's no mystery. So in that situation, since they're directly adverse to his position, Rule 3.3 says he should have brought them to this court's attention. I apologize for not being able to. I hope the court can accept it. But if there's any doubt of my reading of the cases, I'm sure this court, with its resources, will investigate what I'm saying. I would not misrepresent the facts to the court.
If I might interrupt you, Mr. Fudo, would there be any downside that you can think of if we required the instruction to be given in every case such as this? Can you think of any problem that would create for the trial court or for the lawyers in order to avoid the issue, the very issue we have here?
You know, Justice Duffy, when you say to give the instruction, I don't believe if you were just to give a generic instruction that you have to be unanimous as to all, any and all acts you find a defendant guilty of committing. Would seem to address Justice Acoba and the petitioner's contention in their scenario that a juror could still find this exhibit applies to two counts. So I think there'd have to be a more sophisticated, modified Arceo, if you will. And because, to me, it's contemplating this situation, which is unique, it would be a new rule that should be given purely prospective effect, since the laws existed in this jurisdiction at the time of this trial, didn't require it. So I just don't know how prophylactic applying Arceo to this situation would be. I think what applied to this situation was common sense. And more so with counts 8 through 15, when you have this colloquy between the defendant and the prosecutor, deputy prosecutor. Now, based on the order of protection, you knew that the order of protection said you couldn't contact victim. Isn't that correct? Yes. And you've heard the voicemails that were played yesterday. Yes. And was that your voice? Yes. So those were the voicemails that you had left her? Yes. They're talking about counts 8 through 15. Can there really be a contention that there's plain error such that we can say that there's a reasonable possibility on that record that those instructions contributed to those jurors finding, yeah, you made the voicemails? They had 8 separate exhibits, CD exhibits, dated to November 6. How difficult was that to really figure out? The defense to this was generic. I didn't do it, she's lying. So inasmuch as a defense wouldn't apply more to, let's say, count 8 as it would count 9, it's a very straightforward situation for the jury. Either I believe him, he didn't make it.
Fudo, did the defendant ever contest the date or the times reported by the complainant?
He was all over the place in that. Yes, Your Honor.
My question was, did he ever contest in his testimony the date and the times set forth by the complainant?
So, yeah, in some instances, yes, he did.
Yeah.
He did. He said she's lying. And so that's what I was saying with Justice Duffy. They have a very straightforward problem. Do we believe defendant? If we do believe defendant, 8 through 15, they would have been out. But inasmuch as they didn't believe defendant, and 8 through 15 were all the voicemails, all recorded in exactly the way, all separately marked and dated and given to them, and in light of his concession, it's not the jury instruction that resulted in his conviction. It's the substantial evidence. He really was incredulous. For each and every count they found him guilty, there was a corresponding independent recordation of that count. In the situations when it was the voicemails, they were separately marked and dated CDs, and that would correspond to the date in a group of counts. For the text messages, they received photo images, blow-ups, separately marked and dated. For the messages that were left in the group of counts for 18 through 22, which occurred on the 6th, and then separately dated in the counts that were grouped 23 through 25, which were the ones that were left on the 7th. it wasn't really that difficult for the jurors to sit there and go, 16 counts differentiated by nature and date, and here's the evidence, 16 discrete evidence, they matched. I mean, is that not unanimous? And I'm not going to sit here and say that some juror couldn't engage in some irrational speculation about, no, let's put it here and not here and use it here for not here. But that doesn't constitute a genuine possibility under the federal standard that we've heard here today. That's just speculation, which doesn't support a conclusion that it's a genuine possibility. And that's the modifier, genuine. That's what Justice Moon said in Mundon. There has to be that genuine possibility, not a theoretical or abstract possibility. And that seems to dovetail with the idea of plain error review, that it's got to be real. It's got to be something germane. It has to be a reasonable probability. But I cautiously mention the plain error because to find plain error, it would seem to be that there have to be some agreement that Arceo applied to these facts. And according to the court in Stenger, Horswell, Arceo, and the Arceo progeny, the 264 that I reviewed, it just doesn't apply on these facts. Now, counsel told this court that he had looked and he couldn't find a case on these facts, and that's why it's so important for me for this court to use its resources to see that. But there are two cases exactly with this type of fact where you have the exact numerical correspondence between acts and counts. And in all those cases, this jurisdiction says, no, it's unanimous. There is no plain error. And every case was analyzed for plain error. Again, and to summarize, because I don't believe that the record evinces that there's grave errors of fact, because I believe the record doesn't evince a grave error of law in as much as RCO didn't apply to this situation, in as much as I believe that the record doesn't evince that there are obvious inconsistencies between the SDO of the ICA and the prior decisions of this court and the ICA, that under Hawaii Revised Statute 602.59b, the cert should be dismissed as improvidently granted. On another day and on different facts, perhaps this issue should be taken up. But certainly not on this case with this volume of evidence and the way it was so logically and compellingly presented to the jury so that they could rationally and discreetly determine act to cases. And when the prosecutor made clear throughout the case and in her closing argument that they were tasking the jury to determine whether or not the state had proved beyond a reasonable doubt 25 separate and discrete acts.
Mr. Fudo, not to belabor the point, but how do we know that count 13, which formed the basis of the consecutive sentence, was the specific voicemail that Judge Kubel was concerned with? The one with that he felt threatened her life.
I think I understand your question. You couldn't know that it exactly was, but what you do know is that it was amongst a group of counts that were 8 through 15 that were the voice messages left on November 6th, presented to the jury in the form of her testimony with 8 separate exhibits. So you would know that in as much as they found him guilty of all 8, it was amongst that 8. To find all, it means you found each. Furthermore, I think with respect to the sensing aspect of it, you couldn't know the specific count, but you knew the specific conduct. And it was the conduct that disturbed the judge, and in his discretion, felt imposing the consecutive sentence in light of that specific conduct and the criminal history of defendant that it was warranted.
But a sentence has to be imposed by the count, correct?
I didn't read a case saying that a consecutive sentence has to be imposed by a count, but if that case is in existence and that's what it says, then that's what should happen, and then it should be remanded. Counsel did not bring up that case. I didn't see anybody else bring up that case, and the ICA minority didn't bring up that case. But clearly the conduct for which the sentence was imposed consecutively was definitely found beyond a reasonable doubt and unanimously by the jury, and was also, inasmuch as it was amongst those voicemails which defendant said, yeah, I made, I don't know, again, on this record, I really can't concede, not knowing the case to which you may be referring, that the sentence should be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fudo. Mr. Fujioka, your rebuttal.
Just briefly, I did, in my research, I didn't come across, I'm not sure why, I didn't come across Horsewill and Keonani, but if they say what the counsel says they do, sounds like the difference between them and Munden is that in Munden's case, there was one acquittal and one conviction. And I really don't think it's appropriate to wait until you see the verdict before determining whether there was a genuine possibility of confusion, because that raises the dangerous the danger of every time there is no specific unanimity or election and the defendant is acquitted of one count, then the other convictions get reversed because of the double jeopardy aspect. So giving that due consideration, the potential for or the genuine impossibility of confusion should be assessed before the deliberations and not after. So there really should have been either an election or a specific unanimity instruction. Thank you.
Do you have any answers to his charge that you violated the code of conduct by failing to cite these cases?
If I knew about them, I would have addressed them. I don't know why they didn't pop up when I was doing my research. It might be because I focused more upon multiple acts, multiple counts, specific unanimity, and not just going through Arceo and clicking each and every one of its, the 200-some-odd cases that he says cited that particular opinion. But from what I was looking at, I just didn't come across Horsewill and Keonani for whatever unfortunate reason. But if I did, I certainly would have either addressed them or tried to, if appropriate, tried to distinguish Munden from them. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fujioka. The court will take this matter under advisement.